Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the start of the 2021 budget season. This is our first expanded budget committee, and we are delighted to have everybody here. So I want, before we get started, if you look around your little boxes on your screen, you might notice a new face. So Jason, would you like to introduce Deanna Carruthers?
Sure. Deanna, welcome. Deanna Carruthers, our new Chief Equity Diversity Officer, is joining us today to see the budget festivities and discussions, one of several meetings. So welcome, Deanna. I think this is your second week, correct?
Correct.
Already off to a start. I know you've met with multiple department heads and is already starting to meet with members of the staff and community to start getting yourself affiliated with everyone and familiar with the surroundings. So great to have you aboard. And this is the legislature and some staff amongst the Hollywood squares in your screen. I don't know if legislators want to introduce themselves or, you know, Deanna, maybe just say a few words as to how things are going. And you're not, you're coming to us from Wichita right now, Wichita, Kansas.
That's correct. So this is officially the fifth day of work, and so started last Tuesday after Labor Day. First of all, thank you for this opportunity. I'm honored and humbled to join the Tompkins County community. Jason, Amy, and Lisa and the entire team have been absolutely fabulous to work with. They've rolled out the red carpet for me and made everything as warm and as inviting as possible. The staff have been extraordinarily committed. I've met with all of the diversity, inclusion, and infusion committee. I've also met with several department heads and will be connecting with folks from the community. They've given me all the resources I need in terms of the anti-racist and equity strategy to review those things, including the community and policing initiative and the climate survey. So I feel very, very prepared to do the work, and then also look forward to supporting the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee as well. And so with that, I'll make my introduction brief, but thank you for giving me all the tools and resources, and I'm thrilled to join the team.
Thank you, Deanna. Thank you. Welcome. We are delighted to have you, and thanks very much to the search team, the search committee that helped to sort through a lot of qualified folks, and we're able to bring Deanna in and join our team. So we look forward to working with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to, Jason is going to, this is mostly a Jason show tonight, or at least get us started. You have your schedule, and the departments tonight are Jason presents his budget, then we have county administration, finance, and human resources. Just a couple of words. I would like to aim to have a little bit of a break in between, sort of at the midpoint. So we'll try to do that for everybody to stretch their legs. And you know, we're in, as Jason and I said at the briefing with the media earlier today, we're in an unprecedented situation, unprecedented and with a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and we have our work cut out for us. Of course, our department heads, Kevin McGuire and especially Jason, have done an enormous amount of work to get us to this point, and we are deeply grateful for all their efforts, for the entire team at the county and the county government in working to get us to this point. I think you'll see we have a very balanced and reasonable approach to 2021 presented in Jason's documents. And we have a lot to look at, but I think it's a very reasonable way to approach our situation. I'm very glad to know that the team has been working on it. We will be able to pick our budget books, our big budget books, in hard copy by the end of the week, we believe. We'll certainly let you know about that. And Jason, has a link gone out yet?
It has not gone out yet. I know. I suspect in the next hour or two we'll have the link. When it's ready, when it's posted on the website, we'll send the link out to all legislators.
Sounds great. All right. And we deeply appreciate it. And as always, we appreciate ITS making all of these little boxes here able to work and talk to each other. So thanks to everybody in the team. And as we are about to roll up our sleeves, I want to thank all of you for being prepared to dig into pages and pages of numbers, juggling policy decisions, and all the uncertainties that we have to look at as well. Just two other points I would make. I want to just say, I think there should be no quota on questions. I think everybody can be responsible and know that if they've thought of a question, probably one or two or three other people have also thought of the same question. So as we go through these presentations, as we've had in the past, these presentation meetings are not a time for us to debate among ourselves, but really to get as much information out from our departments and our administration as we can. But I really want to encourage people to feel, really empowered to ask questions that they have. You're probably not the only one with that question. Now, that said, I do want to stipulate that when one person thanks a department head for their presentation, let's just say that person is speaking for all of us. So we don't all have to thank everybody. Let's just understand that's a given. We're all deeply grateful for all the work that goes in every day, and in particular in putting our budget together. So, and if you get mad because that's maybe usually going to be me because I'm leading the meeting, well, maybe we'll just take turns, but we don't all have to spend that time thanking everybody. Let's use it for our questions. Speaking of questions, are there any questions from any of you right now before we get started? Not seeing anybody. All right. And Dan and Mike, is it just the two of you at the table in the chambers?
So far. And Kathy.
And Kathy, right. So if you, please, if I don't see you as we go along, feel free to holler out in case I'm not able to see your hands up. All right.
Thank you.
With that, Jason, do you want to get us started?
Sure. Will do. Thank you, Martha. I appreciate it. Thank you, everyone. So I'm going to share my screen and hope that this works out. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
It's is it changing? No, is it? Hold on a second.
Not yet.
Let me just make sure. First time with a split screen, so I'm going to try and see if I can get it to work here. How about now? Is it changing slides?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
We're good.
Thank you very much. So thank you for the introduction. And I think a special thanks goes to, again, to the folks that helped really put the budget together, which is the staff. The department has the agencies. I don't want to forget about the agencies because they've been working diligently as well to ensure that they can continue to provide service and continue to play an important role in the community. I started the budget message with a practical understanding that we are still in the midst of a pandemic. And unlike anything that most of us have ever experienced, I think anything any of us experienced in our working careers, this has created, it's unprecedented, which is, I think, the common word, and it creates an absolute amount of uncertainty. So to be able to base our budget off of consistent past practice or consistent historical information becomes very difficult in certain instances, for example, like what state aid will be, impossible, more impossible than it's ever been. So as we go through the budget, you'll notice that, we are trying to take as many conservative but yet practical approaches and providing opportunity to cushion or to react to what the market, meaning the economy, may throw at us and what the state may throw at us in terms of unknowns. There is a large contingency increase in this budget, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And that's pretty much because everything that we've heard since April to date is that if the state's financial picture does not improve, it will hinder our financial picture from their perspective. So there's a large allowance for some amount of unknown future. However, that may or may not be enough, so we don't know. Revenues became particularly difficult to estimate, more so in sales tax because of no historical way of measuring what it means when a community shuts down and its local economy shuts down. That's never happened before. So we will talk a little bit about the basis that we looked at from that perspective. And then also what we do have control over, which is measuring our expenses. I think one of the underlying themes that is the success of this budget is that we were able to reduce the workforce size by 6%, which is about 47 FTEs, but we were able to achieve no layoffs, meaning no one will lose their job as a result of it. And I'll talk more about that. I think that's important. And lastly,
excuse me, Jason, did you mean to move your slide?
No, not yet.
Okay, okay.
Give it a little summary, a little bit of an overview. And then lastly, a good effort has been to maintain the capital program. So while we have no understanding as to what the future may or may not hold, I think we have put together a reasonable approach for the budget process to really start, which is where it starts with which is with the legislature, which is with you, to be able to review it, change it to best meet the needs of the community and then ultimately adopt it. So I guess I'll move forward and just start with the brief summary. Summary being that, like I just mentioned, no layoffs. No layoffs, I think, is a great accomplishment. We'll talk a little bit more about the details of that. I was able to meet today with staff, the impacted staff, and acknowledge the difficult situation that they're in, but also started to talk to them a little bit about what we are doing to provide a placement strategy to provide a job to every one of those 18 impacted individuals if they want one. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get through to it. Revenue concerns, this budget has an 8.9% decrease in sales tax compared to the 2020 adopted budget. We anticipate that while sales tax will be down compared to 2019's actuals, it will probably be up a little bit compared to 2020's actuals, although we don't know that yet. Nonetheless, it's still coming $2 million short of what we budgeted for the current year. Casino revenue, the reason I have that as a specific mention is because it was about $1.5 million worth of revenue in our budget. It is down 55%. Casinos up until recently were allowed to open or were shut down from March. They just recently were allowed to open at 25% capacity. I think both casinos, particularly the DeLago up in the Waterloo area, has had financial troubles, and it's yet to be determined whether or not they're going to stay open long term. But this is a decent, significant decrease in revenue from them. And then lastly, the potential reduction of state aid could be 20%. The governor said it could be more depending on whether or not there's a federal relief package or what the state's financial position is. The levy is up 4.97%. The rate is only up, the tax rate is only up 1.17%, and that's primarily because of a jump, again, a continued growth in taxable assessed value. And I don't know that that's going to change a whole lot moving forward. And then there's also a proposed $5 increase in the solid waste fee. Total impact on the average homeowner of a property of $200,000 is $83 a year. Economic fiscal indicators. Generally, I usually go through this to talk a little bit about some of the current state of things. Generally, I show the past several years of comparison. And instead, I thought it would be more valuable to show the most recent month's comparison, particularly from unemployment. Unemployment is obviously, is an important driver when we talk about economic stability. More people that are unemployed, the less disposable income, hence a decrease in sales tax, the less purchasing of consumer goods. And sales tax is our second largest revenue. In this case, as you can see, Tompkins County in July of last year was at 3.9% unemployment, very low, one of the lowest in the past decade. July of this year, it is almost tripled to 9.9% unemployment, just under 10. We are generally doing better than the southern tier and the state on a regular basis, but it goes to show you that there is some significant challenges, and unemployment will be a key indicator, I think, that will correlate with economic recovery. Consumer confidence, again, this is U.S.-wide consumer confidence, not always necessarily directly impacted, but as you can see, consumer confidence is one of the lowest it's been in the past almost 8 years or so, where you reached a high in 2018, and you see some high peaks in here. Again, this is just showing willingness on behalf of consumers to purchase goods and services. The Dow Jones, again, not always a direct correlation with our economy, but usually some similarities. Despite the dip, which happened around the time when the shutdowns took place and when in when we started to experience some serious challenges. And I think if I remember saying earlier this year, there was the single day lowest dip and the single day lowest increase in the history, which kind of talks about its instability. There has been some stabilization, but I would say this is still not necessarily always a reliable source of stability and is still probably very vulnerable. Economic and fiscal indicators, SNAP. So in this case, I started, again, rather than showing past year's history, I thought it was more relevant to show you most recent month's history. And as you can see here, I don't know if you can see my cursor, you can see in 2020, we had a spike in cases in March and April, and unemployment insurance, or the extended unemployment benefits, started to kick in. And you saw applications start to decrease in May, June, and July, and then increase again in August. Because that enhanced unemployment benefit was counted as income, they no longer qualified for SNAP applications. Therefore, applications went down. This is, you know, an indicator of what that unemployment benefit did in the local economy, which I would suspect if I'm looking at August and September sales tax, there might be a continued slowdown as we extend into future months due to the unemployment benefit and enhanced unemployment benefit not extending. Fortunately, around the time of August, we have higher ed that came back into in-person classes, and that may offset some of that. But nonetheless, this is a direct correlation to what happened with the unemployment benefit. Again, when I look back, it's still higher than it was in 2008 pre-recession timeframe, and that was even in the good time, you know, at a better time pre-COVID. 10F, 10F again is family assistance, federal benefit with a lifetime, a 5-year lifetime eligibility. What's interesting about this chart is even during, and you'll see it more relevant on the next chart with SafeNet, there was not an increase in cases of TANF. And what we have seen, if you remember, over the past several years is a decrease in TANF cases and an increase in SafeNet cases, meaning as folks may exhaust their eligibility on TANF, they are then turned over to the SafeNet benefit, which is a state benefit. In this case, TANF has no local cost. It's a federally reimbursed cost. But when individuals or, I'm sorry, families come off of TANF and go on to SafeNet, there is a local split. And that split, I believe, is 71-29. So we are paying 29% of that cost. And as cases come off of TANF and TANF decreases, but yet they increase onto SafeNet, we pick up a larger local share. And in this case, you can see a large portion of SafeNet cases starting to increase starting in April, May, June, and July. I guess I should have started that the blue is 2019 compared to the orange, which is 2020. And it's obvious here. I just want to make sure we understand what we're talking about. And this is a direct reflection of what has taken place as a result of unemployment and challenges that have come across with respect to the COVID and impacts of COVID. It also indicates that a lot of the new applications were safety net applications as compared to TANF. We get an increase of expected costs related to safety net in our budget, which was a direct reflection of this. So that kind of talks a little bit about the indicators, both around the economy and how that drives some of the budget impacts and ultimately budget decisions that we consider when we put together the proposed budget and ultimately some of the things that you'll consider when you make decisions. Major budget drivers, again, revenues, sales tax, tax base, casino revenue because it's a large one. And expenditures, the capital program, we'll talk about some adjustments with the capital program, labor costs, and then, of course, our favorite statement, unfunded mandates. Sales tax, so sales tax on the average over 15 years has been up 2.5%. That's a good, healthy growth year over year. We had some exceptions, as you can see, 2009, 15, and 16, where you saw regressions in that on an annual basis. Some of that really wasn't explained. And then you have just, what I would call unprecedented again, but in a better sense, growth from 17, 18, and 19. And that's year-over-year growth. That definitely is not shared across the state, although I think a lot of counties did benefit in similar ways, but just not in those numbers. And then, of course, you see the bottom coming out of this in 2020 with what we are expecting, a 14% decrease compared to 2019. Yet to be determined, but that's what we're projecting now. And as every month goes by, our projections get a little bit closer to where we think they're going to be. this, you know, this, I used to have a series of slides, if you remember, where we used to talk about a better case scenario and a worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario had like a flat year or a 2% decrease in sales tax. I'll be honest, I never modeled anything that would have had a 14% decrease in sales tax. Nonetheless, the charts don't quite reflect what we're seeing. But in this case, we have where we are in 2019. It's always better to see the actual above budget when we talk about revenues. That's just not going to be the case this year for obvious reasons. So we're expecting roughly about a 14% drop in sales tax for this year. And then this indicates basically for 21, just under a 9% decrease in the budget amount from 2020. These show some slower growth, which is about a 2% growth per year. But I'll be very candid. This is impossible to project. The only thing we can do is understand what it looks like. And a 2% growth at this point in time would suggest it would be similar to the average growth you've seen over a 15 to 20 year period of time, assuming there's some recovery over the course of the next 18 months. Yet to be determined, and I don't know that it's impossible to understand what 22 and 23 will look like. So in comparison, I think I mentioned this at the, it wasn't this last Ledge meeting, but we just got this information in a few days ago. The January through August sales for compared to 2019 for our county is down about 14.6%. I think I mentioned, or Rick had it at the last or the Ledge meeting or the one before that, NYSAC sent out the comparison of March through May sales by county. And Tompkins County had the third worst March through May sales from 2020 compared to 2019. And while we, it's hard to determine the exact reason why, I think there's probably a high correlation between higher ed closing and shutting down, no graduation between March and May, and why our sales tax dropped to the third worst in the state out of all counties. There's probably a good correlation between that happening and why those numbers show the way that is. So it kind of shows you in a little bit of a reminder of the importance and the value higher ed has in the community and the volatility you can see when you have a major economic influencer like higher ed in the community, both good and bad, obviously, for a variety of reasons. With this slide, another thing that does not help us is when the state of New York decides to take sales tax off of the top of our allotment. And we experienced this last year in their method to fund a state revenue sharing mechanism like AIM Aid, but yet requiring us to fund that share. So I guess maybe it's our revenue share that we should call it, because we're the ones funding it now, where they basically have taken off $387,000 off the top of our sales tax allotment and distributed it and redistributed it to the municipalities, relieving the state of its responsibility to make that cut or to share that aid. With this last budget in the state, they adopted the distressed hospital fund or distressed medical facilities fund, in which, all counties over 2020 and 21 are to contribute a certain amount of sales tax to a distressed fund for hospitals and nursing homes. And rather than pay it in 2020, the state decided to delay that so that they can collect it all in 2021. This is a sunset provision, so it will most likely be highly contested in the next budget that the governor puts forward, because I'm sure there'll be a motion or an exercise to make it permanent. But as you can see, these two actions over the past 2 years have taken almost $1 million off of the top of our sales tax. $1 million. $1 million is close to a 2% tax increase for us. It's not small money. It's probably one of the bigger swipes and changes that the state has done that impacts us the most. But it doesn't help. So when we budgeted the expected sales tax, we actually incorporated the loss of this revenue as part of that projection. And lastly, when it comes to sales tax, economic recovery is unpredictable. Unemployment will play an important role, or I should say employment should play an important role, is whether or not sales tax grows or the pace it recovers. The amount of folks that have jobs that are receiving income and as that income grows will contribute to economic recovery. tax base. Tax base is, in this essence, one of the stronger elements of our local economy. Our tax base right now is roughly split residential to commercial properties around 55% residential, 55% commercial. It's roughly about 50-50, give or take a little. Our real estate market is stronger than most. I would say one of the strongest in upstate New York from a countywide perspective. Development has definitely helped maintain that growth. And both your residential and commercial value properties continue to grow. This again is hard to predict as to how this is going to react during the pandemic and then post pandemic. I can tell you that I don't think, and from my discussions with Jay Franklin, our assessor, that the residential market has slowed down much. In fact, it's probably continued to keep a steady pace. I think the commercial market is yet to be determined. We are starting to hear from some commercial property owners that, obviously with certain businesses either not in business or just starting to come back online, lease payments, rent payments are down. So that may have an impact on the commercial values of properties, but we don't know for how long or if it's consistent or not. So it's yet to be determined the impact of the taxable assessed value growth or on taxable assessed value. I think it's safe to say that while we see here these blue bars show constant growth on a regular basis, it's probably reasonable to assume that growth will not be as much in the next year and thereafter as a result of some negative impact from the pandemic, or it may level off. I don't think we're in a position to say it will reverse. And I think based on the last recession about 10 years ago, I don't think the taxable assessed value regressed like some of the places downstate did. It just didn't grow as much. So I think a solid part of our local economy is the basis of the real estate market. And these are just some statistics to show you the growth. I think most communities would be envious of being able to say your tax base grew almost a third over the past 10 years. A good portion of that also is in the city due to some of their growth. Lastly, casino revenue. Casino revenue was new revenue that came about in 2018. We get uniquely, interestingly, we get fed from two casinos, Tioga Downs and DeLago. 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, when the direction came out from the governor that casinos could open at a 25% capacity, I emailed the chair from the Tioga Board of Supervisors, Marty. I forgot her last name off the top of my head, but we're on the control room calls together, and I asked her, does Tioga Downs expect to reopen? She said, yes, absolutely, they expect to reopen. DeLago has had some financial troubles, I think we've discussed openly, around bond downgrades, and the revenue projections weren't as good as they expected during good times. I think it's difficult to say what's going to happen with the casinos. Last year, they came in at $2 million, which was well above our budget. I think it's probably part of the contributor of why we had a large surplus the past 2 years, is this revenue has probably come in $1 million over what we budget every year. And we increased it a little bit in 2020. And unfortunately, it was the wrong year to increase it. And as of, I think, July, there was about $420,000 collected for the year. And that was based on just the first several months. Don't expect much more to come in this year. And what we did is we basically cut in half the amount of budgeted revenue we're expecting from the casinos. So it probably took $600,000 or so out of the expected revenues and the impact on the general fund. And then lastly, state aid. State aid is an unknown. The state has confirmed that they're having liquidity issues. I think this is well known now for the past several months. They have openly said that, and this was, I want to say, back in June when we were supposed to have the initial thought of another federal relief bill in mid-June. The state was waiting to determine what they were going to do about withholding a certain 20% of state aid in certain instances. They've been very open about the fact that if a federal relief bill does not come, that they will most likely cut aid or aid to localities and municipalities while trying to keep their school aid intact. That translates in anywhere between a 20% greater increase in cut in state aid. Clarity is, again, on state aid. just to remind everybody, state aid comes in many forms and fashions, usually through reimbursables for services that we're mandated to provide. It's not unrestricted revenue by any means. It's reimbursements for this service or reimbursements for that service. So cuts in those areas could be significant. Roughly, if we were to have a 20% cut in all of our state aid, you're talking about a $5 million reduction in state aid, which would mean most likely either cut in services on our end or an increase in local share, meaning we would have to make that up through property taxes or some other revenue source. So big unknown that's supposed to happen here. The governor has not exercised his right to amend the financial plan yet, but I think we're anticipating something either this month or next month. I say that. We've been saying that every month, but I'm sure it'll happen sooner or later, and then we'll go from there. I think I mentioned this at the budget and capital personnel meeting earlier today. I'm expecting that the January budget, that the executive budget comes out, will probably have some sweeping changes in areas, and it will be a very active legislative session between January and March. Most likely, NYSAC and legislators gearing up and trying to lobby to minimize whatever either increase in unfunded mandates or decreases in aid that's going to be proposed. But I suspect we'll have a lot to lobby for, so to speak, come January. Workforce. So that wraps up a lot of the revenue. I can stop, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer questions, or if you'd like, I can go through, just keep rolling on it.
Well, let's see, that's a good place to stop for a second. Are there any questions? With the way this is going, I can't really see hands. So if anybody has any questions, just unmute yourself and go for it. All right, I would just mention that state diversion to the hospital fund that you mentioned before, the two-year sweep. If folks remember, that was kind of the legislature's negotiated settlement. The governor wanted to increase our Medicaid local share on an ongoing basis by a big chunk. We were fighting that, and the legislature was able to negotiate just for now a two-year increase from our pockets. So a little context there, that's all. All right, no questions? Leslie, go ahead, I see a hand up.
Thank you very much. Jason, the TANF and safety net.
Yes.
TANF, as you described, that money, that's reimbursable. We get that money.
Yes.
That's paid for by the state. Safety net is what is mainly local share. We pay that.
We pay 71%
of that.
Yes.
Now, with TANF not, can you go back to the TANF slide?
Yes.
So there hasn't been much movement in that, but we saw more movement in safety net once, you know, the unemployment stuff went away. Do you have an idea of what that cost difference is? Are we paying much more now? Just raw numbers. I know the 71%.
I don't know right now. It's something we can probably talk about. I can tell you what we are projecting increase as a result of safety net, and that's in the mandate slide. There may be a delay in understanding that too, but I think that's something we can ask. Meaning, is there a way to quantify, you know, what these increased costs and safety net may mean monetarily? It may be difficult because I mean these things. These cases obviously aren't a one-month type case. They're multiple cases,
right.
They're cases over multiple months. But let me see if there's a way to quantify, you know, is there a value to this or not? We can ask that question, Leslie.
That will be helpful to know. Thank you.
Yep.
So, Jason, there's a sort of ongoing shift from TANF to safety net as people's five-year eligibility for TANF, as they reach their 5 years, they move to safety net. So that's kind of the baseline. So what we're seeing in April, May, June, and July, those big upticks, that's really the consequence of unemployment and COVID.
Well, I will say also it's going to be difficult for several reasons. The safety net cases, obviously, when the pandemic hit, a lot of restrictions were waived. So for folks to recertify to get the benefit was an automatic thing. So it's probably practical to say that some of these cases may not have existed otherwise if the normal regulatory measures were in place, because either they would come off for a reason, or they wouldn't recertify for a reason. So you have, I think, an ongoing number of cases that kind of ebbs and flows a little bit. And then then the question is, how many is a result of the pandemic? Either way, it's safe to say that the pandemic has increased the number of public assisted needs. But we can try to quantify it and see what that might mean. I can also get the data of what the actual number difference is and give you a percentage difference. Like, this is an actual number of increased cases, but I'll see what
I actually think. The latter of what you said is what I was looking for. So thank you for clarifying a little bit more for me. That's more what I was looking for, because I imagine, as you said, they all weren't, because people reached their 5-year limit. There was that increase. Unemployment had something to do with it.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I'll see what we can dig up on that. Okay.
Jason?
Henry?
Jason?
Henry.
I know with the real property things, what is the assessed value going to have to do with the future?
Well, obviously as taxable assessed value grows, particularly commercial taxable assessed value, you're able to spread the cost of government services over a larger base. So from a distribution of cost perspective, it's always helpful. And this way, the more tax base grows, that means the more you spread the value of government services across. Also, as your tax base grows, many times that over the past 6 years, even though you've increased your levy, your tax rate has decreased. And if you notice, I said the tax levy increased 4.97%. So you had just under a 5% levy increase, but your tax rate only went up 7 cents, which is a little bit more than a percent. That's because the growth of the tax base was able to absorb a greater part of that levy increase. If, for example, the tax base starts to shrink, let's say it goes backwards, I don't think that's going to happen right now. It's hard to predict. I would expect that the growth will slow down. So rather than having a 3 to 4% growth per year over year, which is high, you have maybe a 1.5 to 2%, which is normal, I think. That just means you have less taxable value to spread the cost of government. If it were to decrease, that's going to give you some other indicators, which are going to be not just bad for our budget, but it's going to suggest that property values are going down, meaning property is becoming less valuable. For property values to become less, you've got to see changes in other financial and economic factors like income. Demand has dropped off. One of the things that drives the value of your properties is demand, because there's more demand than there is supply of, say, for example, the housing units or commercial properties. If values of properties drop, it means they're being sold for less, or the income being generated from them is less. So there's a ripple effect that's going to happen in your economy. That's not a good place to be in. I don't foresee that right now, but that would be the ripple effect of what would happen if you saw property values drop. Does that answer your question, Eric? It's a theoretical, it's more of a theoretical answer. It's hard to give you a data number on that, but that would create a compounding problem for us if our property values began to drop.
I think I've heard, maybe it's from Jay or somewhere, that the residential market is doing great. The issue is the commercial, because as people, people are working from home, are businesses going to decide, are more businesses going to decide that they don't need as much of a physical footprint? So is commercial, the value of commercial, the demand for and therefore value of commercial property, is that going to really take a hit? And so that could hurt us.
Any other questions before I move on to some expenses? Okay. So the next slide is just about workforce. Again, we've proposed a reduction of about 47 FTEs. That's not 47 sole positions, it's full-time equivalents. It's about a 6% reduction in the workforce from the prior year. Nearly two-thirds of departments have experienced reductions in some form of staffing. And there is, as you probably remember, every department has an FTE page, so you'll be able to see changes in staffing by positions because we have position titles. And then we also have a summary page in the budget book that shows you the summary of that. Usually it fluctuates by a position or two depending, post release of the budget, we identify maybe an error here or addition or subtraction there. But for the most part, that's going to be probably within accuracy of it. So as you can see, a lot of departments are impacted as a result of some staffing reductions. And then 18 employees currently are in those positions of those 47 that are filled or are proposed not to be funded next year. And we've worked on a placement strategy to be able to offer them a position elsewhere in the organization for a position that has to be filled. So kind of the parameters around that is that we took minimum qualifications of these 18 employees, identified vacant positions in the organization that were going to be filled, and tried to match up qualifications by title with potential openings. So where we had similar titles, we could match them, even though they might be in different departments. And also trying to manipulate and maneuver within the civil service system, collective bargaining agreements, and so on and so forth. I have to give a lot of credit to Lisa Holmes, as well as Laura Granger, and probably the half a dozen or so department heads that said, yes, we understand that this is an important issue for the organization. We will take those individuals in our vacant positions. They weren't, they didn't have to, but they were willing to do it. And these, 18 employees will be talked to over the course of the next 2 weeks of identifying the position that we've matched them with. In some instances, it's similar title and similar grade, and in other instances, it's not. And that's just, the nature of what we're trying to do. We don't have an equal, equal share of those positions. But if the individual wants the position, they're going to be offered it. It's not an interview. It's an offering of the position. And they'll have a probationary period as they would normally. And in some instances, there may be a provisional appointment, meaning they have to take a test and then score high on the test, but at least they'll have the position. They can prepare for that test. And if they choose not to take the position, we obviously won't contest any unemployment or anything along those lines. That'll be an individual choice by individuals. Bottom line is if they want a job, they will have a job. It'll be salaried. It'll be with healthcare benefits, and they'll continue to work for the county and receive retirement healthcare credit. So I view that personally as a success through this process. Employees have gone through a lot. Some of these employees are still on furlough from May originally. And I hope that they'll be able to take up an opportunity elsewhere in the organization.
I have a question.
Yes.
So of these 18, when will they find out again? When did you say?
They were the department heads talked to them on Friday, at the latest on Friday, so they were aware of it prior to Friday. And then I actually had a Zoom call today with some of them to kind of talk about this a little bit more.
And how many of them are moving into positions where their pay is reduced?
I don't have the answer to that, but we can find that out.
I'm just wondering, and could you also just keep us updated on how many, what percentage didn't choose to take the job that was offered?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Jason?
Yes.
Are you going to be continuing the hiring freeze, soft freeze that we've had?
I've had the flexible freeze still in place. So we review vacancies as they come up. So yes, that's still in place, Mike, till the end of the year. And I think as these positions come up, there may have to be some discussion of moving people into what would otherwise be vacant positions.
But this is the 2021 budget. I'm wondering about for that. Are you going to make a decision at the end of the year whether to continue it?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question. I mean, right now the expectation is that at the beginning of the year, we would allow positions to be filled. I would lift the freeze, so to speak. you know, the only thing that I could see that could change that would be if we have to think about mid-year corrections again, say after the budget is adopted, state budget is adopted, or if there's an economic downturn again.
Okay.
Labor costs, we have one contract that's in place for 2021, the blue collar agreement. We do have some set asides for assumed labor settlements, which would be in comparison to the other existing agreements. And one of the big work items we have on for next year is to get contracts settled with our sheriff's unit, our deputies, our correction officers, and white collar. White collar expires at the end of this year. We've had some preliminary conversations just about starting up, but we have not had an opportunity to set some dates for negotiations. Corrections officers are in fact finding, and then the deputies have filed for binding arbitration. So hopefully we'll have some resolution in the next year to try to get some labor contracts settled. Healthcare, which figures into fringe, the total fringe cost. Healthcare premiums, they're not finalized yet. The consortium, I think, will be voting this month. But we budgeted a 5% of increase of healthcare premiums. This was based, I think, on the Audit and Finance Committee's recommendations. But changes in retiree healthcare, basically the efforts that you took, I think, in June or July, and decreases in the number of positions provide for about $250,000 decrease in health insurance costs. That's a good thing. This year pension contributions went up, and this was part of the reason why we had a delay in the delivery of the budget. I think it was a good reason, is the contribution rates came out, which usually come out right after we finalized the budget, but this year we wanted to wait for it because we figured it would be negatively impacted, and it did. At the end of the day, though, our total fringe cost only went up about 1%, about $45,000. So in most years, I would say it goes up anywhere between $800,000 to $1 million. And in this case, it's only gone up, a lot less than that, about $45,000 from the prior year. Again, a lot less positions. Funding healthcare and some changes to retiree healthcare being a big part as to why that's, I think, been kept flat. I should mention one other thing about these vacant positions. So we had, I think, roughly about 40 people taking advantage of the retirement incentive, the healthcare retirement incentive. About 10 or so of those positions are proposed not to be funded next year, where I think roughly about 30 of them are, which was about roughly where we kind of estimated. So about half, I'd say, well, 18 of the positions are filled, half of the other positions were vacant. So they were either not filled during the year or they were part of a retirement or a pending retirement. Just wanted to kind of give you that balance of the remaining portion of these 47 positions. Mandates. Over the past, I would say, 5 years, we've had a little bit of a leveling with little to no increase on a year-to-year basis when it comes to mandates. This year, it's interesting. It's a lot different in a variety of different ways. So from a human service mandate, the total net impact has gone up about 2.25%, just roughly about $500,000 over the prior year, meaning the 2020 budgeted. As you can see, there's the expected increase in safety net, which is about $1 million. That's attributed to what we are seeing now with safety net cases and what we may see into next year. There's been a reduction in foster care aid, and that is looking at to increase. There's some several nuances to that too. So I can't speak to every detail of it. Kit and probably Tom Herden are the best to explain it in more detail, but as a result of this reduction in aid, we're expecting an increase of about $800,000 in that area. And, of course, I think we knew after the April state budget was adopted, the increase in the 730 costs. If you remember CPL's Criminal Procedure Law 730, in an instance where an individual is awaiting trial that is unfit for trial and they've been hospitalized, before this, the county would share the cost of that with the state 50-50. As of the budget, the executive budget that was adopted in April, they shifted the entire cost over to us, which meant we would experiencing roughly a $350,000 cost increase. And that $350,000 is kind of basing it off of the past several years. I have not, you know, I don't think we have enough time under our belt right now to see what's happened over the past 6-8 months to be able to say there's a trend in place. We'll probably have to wait till we get halfway through next year to see, has bail reform changed any of this, which I think is the biggest question. I don't know the answer to that question, but we'll monitor it. But nonetheless, you know, we're expecting an increase in unfunded mandates as a result of it.
So Jason, on that one, so this is not an actual, like, 2020 experience in this line?
Yeah.
Okay.
The other problem with this expenditure, Martha, is it comes sporadically. It doesn't come like every month. Like, you could go no months with nothing and then get hit with a big bill for it. You know, so there's not like we can look at trending, you know, January's high, July's low. It's really a year end type thing. And there's no consistency with it. You know, you could have one person that we could, or two individuals that we could be, that could be a hospitalized as a result of it. And it could be, you know, twice the cost or three times the cost, but yet, you know, you may have five people where it's half that. There's just no way to predict it. So I think the only thing we can look at is see averages over several years and then go from there. Unfortunately, this is one of those things that I don't think is really easily predictable. An offset to these increases was the change in EFMAP aid, which is a Medicaid aid. This was a result of some of the changes with the CARES Act, and then some of the specific federal legislation that required that the municipalities, counties receive this benefit so that the state did not take all the benefit. That was worked into the reduction in our weekly shares, which equals roughly a decrease in $1.4 million with the Medicaid. So the offset is good. There was also a decrease of about $200,000 in assigned council charges, or $250,000 in assigned council mandates. I think after talking with Lance, he's expecting a decrease in prosecution costs. I'm sorry, in defense costs, not prosecution, in defense costs. You know, I would say Medicaid is going to be a target again next year with the governor, so I suspect there'll be an attempt to reverse that benefit one way or another. Sponsored agencies, sponsored agencies were extraordinarily responsive to the requests, dealing with their own budget challenges. I again asked them for decreases in their baseline budgets, just as I did with departments. They responded. Human Service Coalition, again, a lot of thanks to the Human Service Coalition team for what they do. Kathy and her team, John, they just always, you know, make it, pleasurable to go through the budget process, but they definitely have themselves organized and work good well with the agencies. There are some one-time OTR requests there. Most of them all one-time and most of them reoccurring. There doesn't seem to be anything new there. And then TC3's contribution. So the total contribution for TC3 between both counties stays flat. Our contribution decreased a little bit. And that's because it appears there's less enrollment coming from Tompkins than there is from Cortland in that relationship. What I didn't have in here is I did recommend TCAT's OTR proposal as well. Contingency is an unknown. You know, we generally have a contingency account for unknown changes throughout the year. They're generally expenses. And it's a benefit. And sometimes, you know, probably compared to most county budgets, it's a good benefit to be able to have on a regular year, the amount of cushion and support we have through a contingency. This year, we felt it was important with the amount of pressure that the state is going to feel financially and the expectation that we'll get the negative end of that. We increased contingency fund, we did more than double it. Again, this could be for unfunded mandates to pick up additional costs. It could be for, you know, shortcomings in aid. I think they're both the same thing. It just depends on what form and fashion they come in. The question I've had before is this enough? I don't know how to answer that question. I think it's a reasonable amount to start with, and we'll have to see and adjust as we go through it. To not do anything, I think, would not be responsible.
Jason,
yes.
Ed asked us to sort of be prepared to, if they have unexpected cuts, does this $1 million assume something there too?
I'm sorry for who I didn't touch the first part.
TC3.
Well, if the cost ultimately comes back to the county legislature, then, you know, you're going to use this for what you need to use it for. You know, I can share, you know, with the group, I did with a bunch of capital and personnel earlier today. I had a meeting with TC3 and the healthcare consortium. Some of you know that TC3 has had cash flow challenges. They're about 90 days in arrears for their payments for the healthcare consortium. This is an ongoing challenge they've had for the past few years. And it's at the point where the consortium wants to see some solution or what their plan is to resolve it. The bottom line is that the community college is in a realm of unknown, probably more so than us. Their revenue is related to enrollment, which has been hit drastically over the past spring semester. And then the state has hit them hard with reductions in aid. So, you know, I would say any expense that falls under your realm is going to come under the contingent fund. You know, if it's a one-time thing or whether it's a target because, that's what they need to survive, it's probably a discussion to be had, when the time comes. But yes, it could be used for that.
Jason?
Yes.
I had a question. I should have probably asked you this in BCP, but if we were to pay the arrearage on TC3's premiums, would they then be able to pay on time going forward? I mean, they're sort of consistently planning to be 90 days behind. So if we wiped out that arrearage, would they be able to stay current?
So it's a good question, and probably one that will become more relevant as we start getting into the next few months and talk a little bit more about TC3. Now, essentially, what you're suggesting is perhaps a borrow or loaning them the equivalent to rectify their cash flow problems, and kind of giving them a new baseline to start on. And then somehow amortizing that out or not. I would imagine probably the first rather than the later. But to answer your question, if everything was static today, yes, I think that would get them into a position where they would be current and be able to pay their bills more promptly. I think the bigger question is what does the forecast look like? Meaning, all right, let's look at if we were to give you an infusion of cash now, how, A, would it look as months go on? What do you know today to be able to determine that you can pay your bills? And then how do we incorporate a payback if that's what the legislature wants to do? If not, then, you know, so I think the more important question is what's the cash flow look like for a 12-month period out? And the biggest challenge that comes with that is the unknown about enrollment, and then what is the state going to throw their way between now and April of next year? So, but I think your question is probably going to be a point of discussion sooner than later over the next 6 months.
Thank you.
Yep. I guess Shauna, and then I'm not sure who the other person is. Henry. Shauna? That's not coming through, Shauna.
I was wondering for the 18 people that we were able to find new jobs. So can you tell me how?
I heard
so could you put your question into chat and we'll go to Henry and come back to you? We can't hear most of what you're saying. I'll take that as a yes.
Sure, thank you.
All right, yeah, thank you. Sean, Henry. Is Henry muted? Henry? Go ahead. Can anybody else hear Henry? I can't.
Yeah.
I can't hear him.
Henry, it doesn't look like you're muted. I see your lips moving, Henry. All right, Henry, have you tried to unmute and mute again and unmute? Try again. No. Oh, man. All right, what's going on? I don't see. All right, Henry's going to put his into chat too, but I don't see Shauna's yet. There we go, Shauna. for the 18 people that you were able to find a different position, how does that how does that save money, especially if those positions were empty and now we will be paying them moving forward?
Good. So those are positions that would be funded and that are considered to be funded into next year's budget. So they were either vacant now, and they're vacant now temporarily to be able to save money, or they will be vacant because someone will be retiring between now and next year. But in terms of the budget for next year, they're expected to be filled to support the department that they're in. So that's why the positions that they are leaving will be eliminated. So that's the trade-off, is that the positions that they are in now will be eliminated, but the positions they're filling are part of a core service or the function of the department that they're going to. I hope that answers the question. I should clarify also, and I don't want anybody to assume this otherwise, but obviously this is a proposal, the 18 positions to be unfunded. If obviously the legislature feels otherwise, that, you know, that's ultimately proposed to you for consideration as part of your adoption process. I just want to make sure we're, you know, clear on that. And that was explained to the employees today as well, while this is still a proposal.
Okay, and Sean says, thanks, yes, that clarifies.
Great.
All right. Henry, you want to try it again? Or type it in? I don't see or hear anything from Henry.
There it is.
Henry, for TC3, since we already double up their payment this winter, when do they not have funding issues?
So I think what you're referring to is we advanced them their payment a year early, or in this case, we advanced some payments in the prior, you know, the year before the succeeding year. We talked about this, I think, the past 2 years when we started to do this, and it doesn't address the structural issue with their problems. It only temporarily addresses their cash flow issue. At the end of the day, the only way that their structural budget issues are going to change is if they have an increase in revenues from where they are now and or a decrease in expenses. So to answer your question, it doesn't solve their problem long term. It only solves the cash flow problem.
Jason, Henry, you got that? Hope that's good for Henry. And I think Deborah's point is a good one, that if we could catch them up, it might be worth doing to, but of course, yes, depends on what happens after that.
Okay.
Any other questions? Lisa, to answer Anna's question about the positions being offered to furloughed employees or those whose positions not funded in 2021, 11 are being offered positions in the same pay grade. 7 are being offered positions in a lower pay grade.
Excellent.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, great. That was fast.
I'll move on. Capital investment or reinvestment. An important part of the capital plan last year was to attempt to achieve a net zero greenhouse gas emissions in our county operations in 15 years. The goal, I think the direction through the energy strategy was identify a reasonable way to fund minimizing or eliminating greenhouse gas emissions as quickly as reasonably possible. In that proposal, we had a very robust initiative of trying to make almost $30 million of investment in the next 15 years by 2035. As we look at the capital plan and trying to continue to fund aggressively and support our infrastructure, some projects got either pushed back on the time frame or were amended. And in this case, we were able to continue to do this investment, but it would be over more of another 5-year period of time, over a 20-year period of time between now and 2040. So while we still kept the initiative and the intent in there, have really pushed back the start a few years to be able to plan and then be prepared to to invest, assuming the economy improves and we have the ability to continue to invest in our infrastructure. So it still keeps it as a priority. It just pushes it back 5 years. As part of every initiative in the budget, we did decrease the amount of capital contribution by about 11%. And there's a little typo there. Sorry, recommends about $770,000 decrease or 11% decrease in the actual capital contribution. And it proposes using about $8 million of fund balance and capital reserves over the course of the next several years. So when we get into capital discussion next week, I'll talk a little bit more specifically about certain projects and the ability to fund rather than borrow through cash, which ultimately allows us to minimize the use of fund balance and reserves in our operating budget and limits it primarily to our capital budget.
Question about this, Jason?
Yes.
What percentage of this, or I guess if you could just summarize, we had put together a $100 million plan last year. $33 million of it was specifically for green infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious where the green infrastructure component stands.
I think this might help with that.
Ah, thank you.
No, this just summarized some of it. And again, I'll talk a little bit more in depth next Monday, but we still designate about $30 million for green facilities. Again, this is pushed out, though, probably several years to the real start and then when we start to incur real debt and make some movement on things. It assumes still $28 million for a downtown campus. This is yet to be determined by the legislature, and it'll be up for more discussion with the legislature. Additional $4 million for public safety buildings. So this is probably one of the biggest changes in the capital plan. And before, we had allotted roughly $30 million for the project. And several factors came into play in talking with the sheriff about this. There are some immediate needs, but there's also a lot of unknowns with jail and jail capacity. Right now, you have bail reform, which is really hasn't been able to set a baseline to be able to look at impact in your jail population. Bail reform started at the beginning of the year, and then 3 months into it, you had COVID hit, and we don't really know how to measure or understand the impacts of bail reform. At the same time, you have some critical investments that can be done now that are necessary to maintain the condition or at least improve slightly the condition over there. So I asked Arel to look at what if we were to do a short-term investment, meaning an investment in 21 or 22, and what that would include. And there's some basics behind some of this investment. So it's about a $4 million investment. And the intent is that you make this investment over 21 and 22, and then you give it about 3 or 4 years, and you evaluate the impacts of bail reform over the course of the next several years to be able to make a better determination as to what size facility or what you want to do with the existing facility. I'll also throw in here something that I think is probably going to be on the table for discussion with the state, and that's most likely probably opening the opportunity to do shared jails amongst counties. This was an issue that was brought up. It was not adopted with the last state budget, but I know it was on the table. There are a number of counties that I know would be interested in having this discussion, you know, with each other. It's been in the discussion on the roundtable of administrators. So I imagine that may be an option that may come forward to us that we may want to consider in future years to partner with an adjacent county. So this was probably the largest reduction in project size, but still maintains a good investment and probably provides a 5 to 7 year improvement to the facility, or at least a few year improvement to the facility till you can make another decision and take up the discussion again. It still has $6 million committed to the airport for the terminal project, which would ultimately we still have to see some debt probably in the next 2 years over that. $6.5 million for backup dispatch center and system upgrades. This is actually a net zero to us because we would pay for it with a state grant that we get annually. And then we again have $1.375 million for electrifying our fleet. Those are just highlights from the capital plan. Today at the Budget Capital and Personnel, and I think later this week at F&I, the resolutions to continue the $1.8 million a year of annual road and maintenance investment and roughly around the same for every other year facility restoration investment. So we continue to maintain our roads and bridges, continue to maintain basic preventative maintenance with our facilities is also incorporated, and that those programs continue in this budget as well.
On the 1.75 for the fleet, mm-hmm. Is that any delay or is that kind of on the track that you had projected last year?
So we still have it in the budget starting next year over the next 4 years. It is less than it was last year for the reason that one of the programs that is being proposed to being eliminated or not funded anymore in the budget is the discontinuation of the Health Homes program. Health Homes is a program provided through the Mental Health Department. We're contracted by a state or their subcontractor, which is Honey, to do that. if we discontinue that program and it goes back to the state to provide, we probably won't have to replace 7 or 8 vehicles that we need to be replaced soon. So there's a little bit of a decrease, about $250,000 decrease in that over the 4-year period of time. That's why it was $2 million last year. It's a little less this year.
Okay, I guess what I mean with the green program was facilities and fleet.
Yeah.
Am I right that we're kind of maintaining the pace for the fleet, but yes, we're slowing down the facilities?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. Yep. Sigler had his hand up.
I actually have 3 questions. Number one, it seems like we're prioritizing the green facility improvements in the downtown campus, and I would have thought that the public safety building was more mission critical than the other two. So just, I don't know if that's a policy debate we have to have or.
I think it is.
Okay.
And discussing it, internally and discussing it with the sheriff, being able to make a decision on the public safety building is difficult at this point because of bail reform. So the question of priority is definitely one for discussion.
Okay. No, I'm just curious because it's my impression that this public safety building has outlived, I guess, the lifespan on certain elements of that building are over. So my other question is the $6 million committed to the airport. It's my understanding that the airport's basically paying for itself. So are we getting that $6 million back somehow? Is it just money that we're putting out there and we're getting back later?
No. The $6 million is an estimated amount of local cost related to, and that's over the cost of a bond. It's the remaining portion of the initial bond, assuming PFCs does not cover the entire cost, which at this point, it doesn't seem like it's practical that it will. There's several unknowns that may bring that number down. One is we don't know how much of the NYSEG award we will or will not get. Some of that can be used towards the debt on that project. The other one is if any of the CARES Act can be used or if we'll have any of it remaining towards the debt. So right now the CARES Act funding, which is about $1.8 million, and I do have a slide on that later, can be used for operations or capital. Right now, we're waiting to see how the year falls out to balance the year, and then we'll wait to see what the impact is for next year to determine how much of that we want to commit towards paying debt. So that could be $1 million, it could be less, it could be none, depending on the impact on the airport fund. The other unknowns that come into play is there is some of the terminal project that can be reimbursed through PFCs, and there are some that cannot. So it's a matching game of being able to use certain funding sources to pay for the debt that can't be reimbursed through PFCs, and the ones that can, you obviously want to maximize. The fuel farm also can't be reimbursed through PFCs, so that is another local cost that we have to figure out what matching source we want to match with it. PFCs are based on employments. So if employments are down like they are now, that means we have less that we're coming in to be able to use against reimbursements. Now, pre-COVID, we had a situation where we were on target to probably exceed employments, the best year ever. And then that obviously stopped. So the recovery of air travel is going to determine a lot about how much we can recover and how much we'll get from PFCs to pay for that debt. Again, an unknown. So that number could be higher than $6 million. It could be lower than $6 million. That's the net local cost. We may end up bonding $10 or $12 million, but we may be able to pay for some of that through the PFC process. The other factor that comes into play is that every year we have a certain amount of projects we do at the airport, and they use a certain amount of PFCs for it. Well, if you only have a certain amount of PFCs and the number of employments is down, that means we have less to put towards certain projects. So there's a placeholder in there to be able to be reasonable about what we can reimburse and what we won't. Last year, we had a $7 million commitment. This year, it looks a little closer to $6 million because of the NYSEG award. We don't know what that is, but that'll definitely help out. And then hopefully we can maximize the CARS reimbursement. But all in all, there's going to be some level of local share. The other thing that could change it, although I don't know how practical it is there's two things. One, there could be another CARS payment or some other federal relief that may help out with that. And two, the PFC rate may jump up. It hasn't been changed in close to 20 years. If that changes, that obviously, even if you have the same amount of payments, we're going to be getting more revenue off it. So there's some movement with this, but it's just too hard to tell and to not budget some level of commitment, I don't know that would be responsible.
What did we ask for from NYSEG?
1.5. That would be good.
Yeah. Mike, did you say other questions?
Yeah, one last question. The electrifying our passenger fleet, I mean, I understand that's $1.75 million, but don't we already budget for the replacement of cars? I mean, the fact that they're electrified is, I mean, it's nice and something we should do, but I would think we'd already have that as like almost like a budgeted line item, like replacement of the computers or whatever the case may be.
You do in some instances, Mike, and you don't in others. And this is really, this was intended to kick this off to convert over the fleet in a quicker time frame, because you normally wouldn't, you know, convert it over that quickly. And then moving forward, it would be, you know, it would be up for a discussion as to whether or not you want to continue to make it an effort of returning it over through a capital program so it's done consistently every year, or whether you want to turn it back to the departments. I'll say part of the electrifying the fleet initiative is also doing a better job managing the fleet and trying to identify where you're right-sizing the fleet and how to best manage it. So it's, you know, we actually have some tools in the electric cars now. Unfortunately, they're not being driven as much, so we can't get a lot of data out of it. But, you know, to be able to tell you usage, who's using them, you know, speeds, driving, you know, tendencies, and help understanding usage. But unfortunately, that's kind of a bust right now because, you know, we're not in the office to use them as much. But as normalcy continues, then we'll be able to do a little bit more of that.
Jason, does that number include charging stations that we have to
increase? Okay. It does. Yeah, it does include charging stations.
Thanks.
Any other questions? This chart just shows you kind of the capital levy compared to projected expenses and the balance in the capital reserve. You know, as I said, when I get generally, you know, 2 or 3 years is a good way to project after that. You know, it's impossible, and right now it seems to be impossible doing 2 or 3 years. So while there may be a little shortcoming out here, it's not significant, but this will adjust as the years go on. So.
What is the size of our capital reserve, roughly?
About $4 million right now. I think we'll end the year. This year we're projecting around $4
million. Thank you.
I left this slide in here just as a reminder. Oh, whoops, I'm on the wrong page. Sorry. I left this slide in here as a kind of reminder about general fund balance update. You know, right around February of last year, we had come off the budget adoption from the prior year. Rick and I had worked collectively to create the fund balance policy, and then, you know, COVID hit, and amongst many things, that was not a policy that we pushed at the time. He and I will get together probably this fall and try to bring it forward again. Again, your current policy is what I would consider very low in terms of kind of treatment, 10% reserve. Generally, GFOA, which is the Government Finance Officers Association, which is your standard for government finance, recommends 2 months of regular general fund operating revenues, which is roughly about $34 million or so. $34 million is about 18%. And we would adopt, most likely recommend you to adopt a policy that would range between 18 and 22. And therefore, because these things are fluid, it's hard to have a set date on them or a set number on them. So giving a range allows you some flexibility from year to year without having to take drastic actions. This just gives you some comparisons. So this is a very rough projection about fund balance and what we can see it come out based of if I were to take a projection of 2020. Again, it's about as good as the moment I created it, but it gives you an understanding as to what you can look at. So I want to just go over a few things with you, and then there's a lot of variables that can go in this. Unassigned fund balance, as usual, your last financial statements is 46,000. This is the number we generally talk about, what's unassigned and non-committed to anything. One-time rollovers from 2020. This is an amalgamation of one-time rollover expenditures that either took place. We took kind of a ballpark of what was adopted, backed off the ones that we know didn't happen, and put a number in here to understand what it would be. Because rollover and one-time really is a fund balance use. A shortfall, this is an estimated operating loss. So that means a deficit for the year. I'll be honest with you. This may be a little high. I hope it is high. I hope it's a lot high. I just don't know what's going to happen with state revenue. And that state revenue shortfall could come this year and next year. Worst case scenario, it could be higher. Best case scenario, it could be half or lower. So this is a moving target that will impact this number. Unfortunately, it's an important moving target that can't be overlooked. Transfer to capital, this has to do with what's in the proposed capital plan of transferring $2.75 million to do capital projects next year from the general fund. One-time OTRs, this is what's been recommended to you in the budget. Obviously, if this changes, this would go up, which would decrease the bottom line number. And rollover, which is what we have proposed in the 21 budget. Again, if this were to change, it would impact the bottom line number. So if all of these things happened, as perfectly as they're put on this paper, you could expect that year end of this year, you would have a $34 million unassigned fund balance and would be about 18%. That's a good place to be. It's a big drop in fund balance, but it's a good place to be. Like I said, there's a lot of variables in here, but it kind of gives you an understanding of how when we look at fund balance, you know, what you could do in terms of being able to manage your security, which is what a fund balance is used for. Other questions?
Yeah, there's a question in chat from Henry. Back to the job question. How many of the 47 jobs are going to be filled anyway?
None. They won't be funded. Those are the positions that won't be funded, the FTEs.
Okay, thanks. Deborah?
Yeah, Jason, I'm trying to understand. If we think we're going to work our way down to $34 million in fund balance in the next year or so, why we would institute a policy which says that we can't spend any more, basically, that we have to keep at that $34 million number. I mean, I don't get it.
Well, I think they're separate of two issues. One is good fiscal policy and management. And adopting a fund balance policy that would reflect what you would want to have in your unassigned fund balance is one, you know, safety measure and good fiscal management that you can adopt. And then it's how do you maintain in, within those ranges, because that's valued as a policy. It's valued as an important safety mechanism. To go below 18%, which may very well be happen, and you might be able to do it through a planned reason. Like, for example, you're planning on dipping into the fund balance over the next year, but your plan to rebuild it over the next 2 or 3 years is a policy that you want to adopt. So, adopting the policy, whether or not you were in a fiscal challenge or not, we would still adopt that policy or recommend that policy for you to adoption because it provides a financial management and security tool as you move forward. If it becomes too difficult to manage, let's say, for example, this shortfall is significantly more, then we're going to come back and say, all right, if this, based on 2020's, you know, year-end results, we're dipping below this number, we would come to you with a proposal to say, this is how we would suggest we build this back up over the next 1 to 3 years. It's about maintaining good fiscal practices.
But how can we come forward with a plan to build back up when we already know, as you've told us time and time again, how unpredictable the next few years are going to be?
I don't think the standard or the policy of what is good fiscal management changes despite the environment we're in. What will change is how you maintain and achieve that good fiscal practice. So if, for example, you adopt a policy and we strive for an 18 to 22% fund balance policy, and we incur more financial troubles going through 2021, then we have to develop a 2022 budget that has some foresight to say, we need to rebuild this. We need to be able to put money back into our fund balance. And this is how we would prioritize this based on all of these factors and other weighing conditions in the operating budget. So I think there are two issues of the policy and good fiscal management doesn't change depending on the circumstance. What you do to maintain it will.
All right, I'm going to ask that we kind of put this aside for now, the budget committee, and then all of us will really dig into this some more. For example, I want to know what the consequence, if we set an 18% rate level and then, you know, go lower, do we like suffer at the bond market, that sort of thing. But I think we got the idea. You're sort of laying it out as a future conversation, but I mean, we're really way over our time. So if that's all right. Okay, great. Thanks.
I'll try to move through. So this is a little bit of a snapshot of the airport. Again, the operations stay flexible. The proposed budget has roughly about a $320,000 operating loss, and that's made up through some use of its fund balance and then use of CARES Act aid. A big portion of this is our increases in costs, some related to the inclusion of the new customs facility, increased costs related to, say, increased cleaning costs at the facility. So there's increased costs related to this. The revenues in the airport fund are expected to be stable, but that's due to an increase in rates and charges for incoming revenue, even though there's expected to be a decreased activity. Some of the things we'll monitor with this is what type of revenue is generated through the customs facility, and then ultimately how does air travel respond to this over the course of the next year and a half. Business and leisure travel is down more than expected. Air travel has been particularly hard hit with the travel restrictions across the country, and how that responds over time will determine how we minimize this operating loss in future years. Fortunately, unfortunately, we do have some CARES Act aid that can be used to offset that. Obviously, anything we used here, we can't use to offset debt. But there are a lot of constant costs that really can't fluctuate a lot with the airport.
Excuse me, Jason. That's $84,000 of the airport fund balance. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
$13 million ban. You recently took out a ban. It'll be renewed or proposed to be renewed in February. This does not mean that's what you'll bond. It means what we've borrowed to float the local cost. All of these things can play a role. The NYSIG grant award, CARES Act funding, all of these can play a role as to what you ultimately end up bonding. And just because you bond a certain amount based on how many PFCs you can apply against it doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be your local cost. Recycling materials and management, there's going to be a lot more to come from this budget. The proposed budget has an increase in the solid waste fee of about $5. It also has a use of some fund balance to balance the budget, which is much better than it was last year. Last year we were in the $300,000 range. So there's been significant improvement despite, I would say, a continual spiral in the downward trend with recycling market, the inconsistencies with the industry. We're still dealing with the increase in the contract costs from 2018 and the collection cost of it. So the fund is performing better, primarily because of some of the increase in the fee from the current year. Nonetheless, there's more to come on this. F&I will be briefed very shortly as to what proposals, what the submissions have been for the RFP for operating the solid waste facility, and then what recommendations are made. Now, those recommendations may impact a decision ultimately made about the rate here or the solid waste fee or what services you provide. So I know Barb and her team and Jonathan are working expeditiously to analyze those submittals and then bring something forward for discussion in the next month or two.
So Jason, that lovely sentence, 2020 projected to finish year with no operating loss.
Yes.
That's before the RFP goes into effect.
Right. The RFP wouldn't, I don't think you would execute a contract till February of next year. And the primary reason we're not expecting an operating loss is because there was a grant that they received unexpectedly. Well, expectedly, but unexpectedly, I guess. It wasn't certain that we were going to get it, and they did, and it really offset. It was a one-time revenue that offset the $300,000 shortfall that they were expecting to at the beginning of the year.
Oh, thanks for that piece of information. So that's not a structural reduction in cost or increase in revenue. That was a grant.
It was a grant. I mean, I think over the past 2 years, increasing the fee has helped balance the budget better because the expenses were exceeding its revenues, and I think it has definitely helped balance it. And Barb and her team have done a good job trying to manage it.
Proposal, the RFP, that will affect the 2021 budget, but you at this point don't know what to put in there.
Correct. Like, there'll be a lot more discussion around what this means and what that'll do to impact what it could mean to your solid waste fee at the end of the day.
Thank you.
OTRs, We had about 3.6 million in requests, about 3.1 are recommended, and then 640,000 in rollover. Here's a breakdown of target versus one time for what was recommended. Most of the target, if not all of the target, recommended were restorations of staff or restorations of components of existing budgets. So you'll notice there were, in order for folks to comply with their 12% reduction, we were able, you know, they had to cut or reduce staff hours or reduce staff. And as a result, after discussions with them, propose OTRs to reinstate that in order to maintain service levels. So that's makes up a good portion of the OTR, of the restorations. Again, this just gives you a snapshot of some OTRs. Obviously, when we get to individual budgets, we'll be able to talk more about those and go from there. This is just a snapshot of them. There are a few of them, like this health homes. While we didn't recommend restoring the program because it's a whole program and it's a policy decision, we created an OTR for you to consider if you wanted to. And obviously, if you voted to restore it, it would add it back into the budget. But we are not recommending it.
Jason, this list that we are looking at are the ones that were not recommended or were recommended? The cow was not.
Yes. So cow was not recommended. I'll talk about that at my budget. It was not recommended, but I did create an OTR for discussion if there's interest of the legislature to reinstate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Here's just a small list of some of the other agencies that were supported. And we'll talk more about them when it comes to their budget time. Here are some totals of requests versus recommended. Risks, sales tax is a risk. We don't know what's going to happen with it. State aid is a risk. Again, we don't know what's going to happen with it. Public assistance could change based on need. Whoops, sorry. And then enterprise units, again, both have some unstable circumstances that we're monitoring to see how it impacts things. Oops. Are there questions? Okay. I always like to remind everyone how easy and simple the tax cap formula is as to how we compute it. So there it is. Obviously, it's clear as mud. This year's tax cap was a different animal than it was in the past. You know, there was that 2 years ago we had what we called the Dryden effect. Of course, the crown jewel of Tompkins County, the Dryden effect, which was the 9 or 10% jump in tax cap due to the sales tax credit. Well, that has come back to do the negative effect to us. So I won't call it the Dryden effect anymore, but it's definitely been negative, and that's not Dryden's fault, obviously. It's just the sales tax credit component of the sales tax cap calculation. Because it decreases, it negatively impacts our tax cap capability. So in this case, the estimated tax cap, in order to stay under it, you would only be able to levy about $450,000 from it. So it's about a 0.88% tax cap. We did have a large rollover, but unfortunately, it did not help us that much. So we'll have a tax cap calculation sheet in the budget to take a closer look at. Nonetheless, obviously the proposed budget would recommend that the override stay intact in order to adopt the budget. Again, the last kind of the end part here, 4.97 in a tax levy increase, no layoffs, 47 FTEs, supports the capital plan. We watch state aid closely because that could change things for us, and the economic recovery will definitely drive sales tax growth, which is our second largest revenue source. Just some summaries, a decrease in the total budget size by about 3.7 million, or just under 2% decrease in spending. Local share, meaning this is sales tax and property tax. This is stuff that's not reimbursed through state or federal aid. It's still a decrease in local spending of about 1.3 million. And, tax levy goes up about $2.5 million, 4.97%. The rate, again, interesting that the rate only goes up 1% because of the growth in taxable assessed value. Again, a 7 cents increase in your tax rate, combined with the solid waste fee, roughly about $83 on a $200,000 valued home. And that is, that's the budget presentation in a nutshell. Again, a lot of difficult, challenging work that went into it. Thank the staff, thank the agencies for their support. Kevin McGuire for his incredible patience. We had a little bit of a mishap last night, which delayed our ability to get the budget out on time. It's always interesting how those things happen in the last hour. We were able to get the software functioning properly, did the checks we needed, feel comfortable in the numbers. And if it hasn't happened already, I'm sure in the next hour or so, we'll have the budget live on the website. And then we'll be able to get you your budget books by the end of the week.
It's live.
It's live. All right. Live and ready to roll.
And going to the link might be much healthier for your for our home computers anyway, rather than trying to deal with a PDF of that size. But thank you very much, Jason. Okay, can I get a motion on that budget? And then, you know, we'll be done. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Jason. I see Rich has his hand up.
Jason, the PFCs, if we bond the amount, we're still allowed to apply the PFCs to pay the bonded amount, even if it's mixed with other capital spending?
Yeah, so right? so you've done that now, and you just did that. So the last capital improvement you did with the airport, I think the debt payment just expired this year or last year. And, you know, you were using PFCs to pay off that debt. And even if you were to refund or refinance all your debt and it were to be rolled into something else, you still, it's an allotment that's given to you to be able to reapply to that. So, yes.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, great. Anything else? I'm going to suggest that we take a break just because Jason is the next department and he might need to stand up or get a drink or something. So.
Sure.
Without, because we are definitely already over our schedule. So how about, let's see, I've got 6:08. Let us be back here at 6:15. All right. Thanks very much, everybody. All right. I'm going to keep talking because we want to, you know, if we're trying to pay attention to our schedule, we've already lost that race, but, I think this is really a good conversation, and I appreciate that it's a good way to learn. So if see the county administrator back, a couple of five people. All right. Jason, are you ready?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Kathy, you ready to go too?
Yes, we are.
All right. Go ahead. Right. Thank you, Jason.
Yep. Hold on one second.
Sure, you can share a screen again?
Yeah, I got to get it up. I'm sorry.
Okay. And I would ask that people make a list of questions, Deborah's on the fund balance policy. Obviously, that'll come back to us. We know that'll come back. But if there are other things like that, make a list. Let's not lose those questions and ideas.
Is this moving the screen or no?
Not yet, and it's not in slideshow. It's, you know, it's in the
okay.
Shows.
Let me try and get this up again.
Okay.
Oh shit. There we go. Can you see that? Is it moving now?
Yes. Excellent.
Okay. So this is the county administration budget. Essentially, you know, we approach this and try in our approach to decrease the budget by 12%. The one I think thing that helped us with this is we were able to look at some restructuring from the target budget. And that is, we had a retirement, and I'll just, I think, jump right to this. We had a retirement, and that's our risk manager, retired after 30-plus years, or is going to retire, take advantage of a retirement incentive. So what we decided to do was not fund that position, and work with our compliance coordinator to be able to share some duties and responsibilities. And there has been some cross training over the past year with that individual in anticipation of this, but also to create some redundancy in contract management and risk management. So we're not going to refill that position. So that is one position that will not be coming back, and that was a target position. And then also the reduction in staffing here are two positions that are not funded again. That is the management fellow that was set to expire this year, and then also the criminal justice coordinator performance measurement position, which was really intended to be an 18-month position that we carried on for, I think, another year after that. So those are the three positions that are not that's what you see. The decrease, the increased position is the chief equity and diversity officer. It's the continuation of the OTR for the second year. As you just met, Deanna has hit the ground running, and this is a continuation of that position, support for that.
Excuse me, Jason.
Yep.
If you go back one slide.
Yes.
So the management fellow, the person who was there, that was a limited time position. But was the slot intended to be target? Was that slot going to move forward?
I think it's a point of discussion. I mean, I wasn't here when the management fellow program was created. And then my first year here, my first budget, I reduced it from three positions to one. I think the intent was to make it a permanent target and trying to, you know, balance a budget and you know, put together a budget that's going to meet a 12% reduction, even though it would have been one time. I decided not to recommend it again. The positions worked out well. The individuals worked out well. I think it's a great opportunity, and they may actually be able to get a position with the county later on. But I just decided not to push it forward at this time.
And I'm pretty sure the criminal justice coordinator was like a 3-year one time, wasn't it?
It was actually an 18-month one time when it was initially created, and we carried it over another year and a half or a year, year and a half, and added the performance measurement piece to it. We think we can be able to, we've got a good foundation of things built on that, and we can redistribute, some of the responsibilities that was taken on by that.
Okay. Thank you.
So here are some OTRs. These are the ones that are recommended, but I already have a change in them, and I kind of would like to talk about the change first and then get to some of the other ones. So if you notice, and I'm sorry this is split on two pages, but there were two specific OTRs around streaming technology. And this was about the legislative meetings and streaming and videoing and making an investment in the AV system for recording legislative meetings. I know Kathy and Marcia prior to that, and Greg Potter and Lisa Holmes had some discussion with Jim Blizzard, who's done a great job for us. Jim is contracted through CCE to do that production capability. There was some interest and discussion around his retirement, and we put together two proposals, one which was a streamlined one, a very simplified one, and then one was a more robust solution. And just today, I know Kathy had some discussion with Jim and decided that he'd be willing to stay on board for another 12 months or 18 months and really work on a larger and kind of more long-term plan. So what I'd actually like to do is I'd like to actually withdraw both of these. We did recommend one. I'd like to withdraw that one as well, and continue to keep the current system in place and work through with the Government Operations Committee and Jim, and now with Dominic on board, who has some great understanding of how we can do things differently, and work with Kathy and Greg Potter, and over the course of the next year, you know, put together a more solvent and a better solution as we go into 2022. So while this one time here was recommended for $50,000, I'm going to request to remove it and withdraw it. As we we'll reengage with CC for another year or so, and then try to figure out what the longer term solution is and bring something to you in 2022. Technology needs to be invested up in the AV room. It's 7 years old. Things have changed a lot. Our ability to stream has changed. This whole pandemic has changed in terms of our ability and capability. I think one of the key discussions to be had with GEO and the legislature is, what do you want that long-term production capability to be? What we're doing now, which is, I think, a benefit, although it's easier to do, is, you know, streaming committee meetings and recording committee meetings, which you normally wouldn't be able to do, pre-COVID. Is that something we want to continue or not? So I think there's some things that have opened our eyes up to opportunities, and it just needs to be balanced out with the interests of the legislature. So that kind of came together the last few days a little bit more, and I think it'd be best to remove it, keep things the way they are for now, and then try to work collectively over the course of next year for something for the 22 budget. There's two other OTRs here. There's the Innovation Initiative and the Community Outreach Worker Program. So I'd like to talk about the Community Outreach Worker Program first. And while I didn't recommend it in the budget, I included an OTR in there for it to be reinstated for several reasons. One, I know this is a policy issue that the legislature has talked about well before my time here. Also, I think we need to have some more engagement with the city and the DIA as to what they want to do with this program and how it fits into the bigger picture. The program has expanded a little bit in terms of its initial intent, which was initially meant to be downtown. I know it has expanded now into other areas of the city to work with our homeless population and folks in need. So it wasn't that I was necessarily in favor of cutting the program other than opening the door to trying to have more dialogue with the city and the DIA, which is why I kept it as an OTR to be considered as a reinstatement into the program. That's really the only thing I had to mention about the outreach worker program. And over the next few days or the next few weeks, I should say, start that conversation with the city as to where they are in their budget process and what they want to do from their end. Do they want to expand the program? Are they going to continue to fund it, or they're not going to continue to fund it?
Jason, the $60,000, that was the total we've been spending?
This year it was increased from 40 to 60. It's to go over it again, it's a contract we have with Family and Children's, and us, along with the city, along with the DIA, and I think there used to be some funders also with the hospital, but I don't think that's the case anymore. We're the three primary funders, supported two positions that supported the homeless population, those in need, and so on. So it was a contract that we had with Family and Children's.
Thank you.
And you said you will talk to the city and DIA?
I think it's a must to be able to see, what the interest is. I know there was a meeting last week. Amy went to the meeting. They're starting to talk about the program, although the city has similar financial uncertainties. There didn't appear to be necessarily a yay or nay as to whether or not they're going to continue or they're going to expand the program. I did tell Dan Kogan on Friday that this was going forward in this format, and we'll have to follow up with him and then have some more discussion.
Thank you.
Jason, I have a question about
sure.
Earlier you talked about the one position that would not continue, and that was half the RBA work and half work with like CJATI, leading CJATI,
yes.
ATI initiatives. That work seems pretty important, so I'm curious if you are going to continue or how you are going to continue the CJATI work and who's going to be chairing that. Just give us a little bit.
Sure. Right now, Dan Cornell is chairing the committee. I think we will continue to evaluate, the chair of that committee. I know once we have an HR commissioner back up in our office, or back up in the HR office, and we have Lisa back up in our office, and hopefully as COVID will hopefully begin to calm down, with Lisa, Amy, as well as Deanna on board now as our Chief Equity and Diversity Officer, I think we'll have enough coverage to figure out how we want to approach continuing to support the dialogue around ATIs on reentry. Again, a lot of it is collecting data and presenting data, but I think we also want to take it into another level, and that is how do we help further some of the initiatives and help them develop more. So it's definitely a priority out of my office, Anna, and I think we'll have the staff to support that.
Wonderful. Yeah, we have been incredibly successful as a county,
yes,
with ATIs and reducing our jail population and our community work. Everybody's sort of really understanding now that it's a public health. We should have a public health focus with respect to, criminality, poverty, all of these that are related. So I appreciate understanding that better.
Yep.
I see Amanda's. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish, Jason.
It's something we'll have to develop as we go over the course of the next, 6 to 12 months. But I think we have a good foundation in place. And I think that was the intent of the criminal justice coordinator position.
Thank you.
I see Amanda and then somebody else who I'll find out in a second. Go ahead, Amanda.
I didn't know if Jason was done with the presentation, but I can wait. Or
I just have one more rollover to talk about, but I can, or one more OPR.
One is a very basic question just about the budget pages, which is, can you remind me what premium pay is on like on the pages? It shows the different breakouts of everything, but I don't remember what premium pay is.
Premium pay is usually a differential that is paid for hourly employees, generally if it's in the evening hours or if it's an off-hour payment. So premium pay usually, that's usually what premium pay consists of. If there's a specific budget that you have a question about premium pay, I can get more detail on it, but that's usually what premium pay is.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And then my other question is, why is the chief equity officer one time? I know it says in here, we've had it in there for 3 years at one time, but why is it like that?
It was proposed as a 3-year, and this is the second of 3 years. So generally after next year, then we would talk about making a target.
Okay.
So we had planned to do the search earlier and have this person most of this year. So yes. 21 is the second year. I see Kevin wrote that premium pay category also includes longevity.
Oh, okay. There you go. That makes sense.
Okay.
And yeah, we don't have any premium pay differential in our budget. That would make sense if the longevity is included. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay. All right. And Henry has figured out his audio.
Yes. I also just want to stress the importance of the community outreach worker in this time of people wanting to defund the police and put money into other systems, that this does in fact do that. That this position in fact, you know, helps with reentry and everything else. So I just want to point that out.
I understand the policy initiative behind the community outreach worker, which is why I purposely put it, as an OTR to reinstate it. So I fully understand what you're saying.
Yeah, let's really try to keep this to questions. We're going to debate with each other later if we can keep moving along. Thank you. Anything else, Jason?
There's one more OTR that I have not talked about, and it's the innovation initiative. The innovation initiative, we're proposing to use rollover this year. It's the first year of 2-year proposal. And this is actually being proposed as a cost saver. A cost saver is a subsection of the fiscal policy, of our financial policy, that talks about an initiative that can save taxpayer dollars or save money by the program. And our intent with this is, over the course of the past several months, we've had some discussions with Greg Potter, Greg being a central part of a lot of folks when they talk about initiating software enhancements. It was Greg, myself, Amy, Jay Franklin participated in Frank Krupa from time to time as we started to talk about if there are changes in the way we deliver services or operational efficiencies, how can we best approach it? And it kind of filtered into a series of discussions around, you know, there are always these initiatives that we want to take on in certain departments, but the staff or the department head doesn't have the resources to commit or designate staff to work on it. And a lot of times it either doesn't get done or it takes, you know, an 18-month period or a lot longer period of time to do things, and not always the greatest outcome. Also, sometimes there is a huge burden placed on ITS because people will view this from the perspective of, all right, I have a software solution, so I want you to help me do it. And there isn't the actual ability to prep, to plan, to assess, to develop, and then to implement and then hand off to the department. And a lot of times either initiatives fail or they just don't get taken up. And so the innovation initiative was about funding a position for 2 years with the intent that we would be able to almost have an internal consultancy that would be able to help spearhead some of those initiatives. So departments have a workflow process improvement or a service delivery improvement that they want to focus on. This is a person that would help facilitate the conversation, work with the department and designated staff, and help motivate, move, and drive that process. Because right now, the only way it gets done is whether county administration plays a critical role in it, which many times we are, you know, we're just like any other department with resource challenges. Departments themselves will try to do it, but they don't have the time or staff to dedicate to it. And a lot of times ITS gets in the middle of that process. So this was about developing a mechanism to to work with departments to help work on internal efficiencies or to service delivery improvements. And the way we have it set up is one position with stipends for five other employees that would dedicate willingly, as well as the department allowing them to, possibly 8 hours a week where they could also help work on innovation initiatives inside the organization. And part of that is for twofold. Number one, it's being able to get some people power from inside the organization to commit to doing it. It also gives an opportunity for existing employees to do something a little bit differently, or something different that they're normally used to doing, which is, I think, a constant feedback I get from employees that, you know, a lot of times, an ability to give an employee an opportunity or reward them, they get an opportunity to work on something they normally get to do. And this is a commitment towards putting together an initiative that can improve efficiency in the organization. So the intent was to set up this initiative, create some metrics to measure success and how we quantify savings and productivity improvements, and then report back on it and see what type of success we have with it. The goal would be to save taxpayer money or increase productivity. I don't know if Amy Hendricks is on or not, and if I don't know if she has anything to add on it. She worked on this initiative a lot over the past month or so. But that's the initiative that we put forward using rollover to support it the first year.
I see Amy is here. Did you want to add anything, Amy?
I don't have anything to add. I think Jason covered it all, and we're just in the beginning phases of looking at how this could assist the departments. And so we've started to reach out more to them to get more information on ways they could see it working as well, additional from those initial ones that Jason talked about.
Well, could you talk a little bit about how this is, the internal consultant has already been hired to do some of this work, the prep work with staff, with department heads?
So no, the internal consultant has not been hired. As we started to work on what innovation could look like, we reached out to someone to help us that knew this. So we reached out to Adria Finch, who is formerly with the city of Syracuse, to help us talk about how we could design a program. And so that's who's been supporting us and working through this with us, is Adria, who is developing the program that could then go to, we would do a formal hiring process to bring on it. Not so much, it's an internal consultant, it's a director that would oversee it, that would be a staff member in Tompkins County. So we're using the consultant term loosely. I think Jason mentioned this in the past, we've used outside consultants to do smart work or help with ITS. This would actually be bringing it in-house, so it'd be a staff person that we would hire next year, bring them on board. They would then have that team of five. And so really you're talking, you know, six county employees that would be doing this work and helping assist our departments. The person that's working with us right now is just kind of doing the research for us and the legwork to get something up and running, as she's already done this in another municipality.
Any questions about that, folks? Deborah.
Yeah, so Jason, you mentioned that this would be a one-time funded with rollover, but then you're also talking about carrying it forward. Once you get this person on board, they'll be a permanent employee?
It's a two-year proposal. So it's a two-year proposal. So what we would do is we would evaluate it over after the two years and see if it's something that you want to continue, or similar to a lot of multi-year OTRs, it would be after an evaluation period, and we would set up some metrics to say, you know, we were able to accomplish this, this, and this, and is this something we want to continue on a permanent basis or not continue on a permanent basis? But it would be a two-year commitment.
And this rollover, as I assume it's from the fact that we didn't get around to being able to hire Deanna until late this year?
Rollover doesn't come from personnel costs. Rollover comes from an accumulation of non-personnel costs and budgets. So in areas where we haven't spent necessarily all full budgets, it then rolls over from year to year to year. So you'll see in a lot of departments, they use rollover to fund certain initiatives, generally one-time initiatives. And that's from where they've been able to save money from year to year, and that accumulates. It's essentially a rollover policy is a policy that allows departments who don't expend all of their funds to be able to capture some of them in future years. So, for example, sometimes you see folks will buy equipment or buy a vehicle or have a different type of initiative that they propose to use rollover for.
So where did this, this is quite a lot of rollover, where did this come from? And I see you, Henry, be next. Where did this money?
I'd have to find out a little bit more of the detail of where the rollover was accumulated from past years. So there could be a series of contracts that didn't come to fruition. There could have been a series of things that weren't expended. You know, everyone's rollover is accumulated through different ways. So when we look at some other rollover initiatives, we'd have to dig into the deeper as to why, you know, what was that included? You know, what was included in that?
Right. But sometimes often, for example, it's actually an expense that we do expect in the future. Maybe it's a grant that we didn't use all the money in the first year, and we will, you know, we do have a plan for it. So I guess I'd be really interested to know where that rollover came from. Henry?
Okay. I guess it sounds interesting, although I'd like to hear more either about the Syracuse situation, about how she changed things in Syracuse. Is there any way to get that information?
Yes.
Yes, we can get that. And I will say that most innovation departments have started in cities and are just expanding into counties. And we've also been working with Bloomberg Philanthropies, who has been helping a lot with these innovation teams as well. So we're learning from throughout the country, but we did work with Syracuse quite a bit on this one.
Okay, thanks.
And I can't remember now who I emailed today. Maybe it was Lisa. These five staff members who are going to get a stipend for 20% of their time. That's on top of their regular full-time salary, correct?
Yes.
Their departments that are losing 20% of their time are not going to get anything. Is that right?
Correct. It's no different than a staff member, you know, wanting to do something a little different, volunteering their time elsewhere. You know, it's an opportunity for empowerment. It's an opportunity for staff to try to do something differently than what they normally do on a regular basis.
So it's interesting because I almost would want to see it flip that you're right, it's an opportunity for that staff person as an individual. The compensation should go to the department that's losing the person but still having to support that 20% of their salary. All right, I guess we can talk about this some more. Are there any other questions about this?
Martha, if I may, just on that question you just had, one of the things that the department may have is when we look at the prioritization of projects, it does give the department the potential for flexibility that the department would be one of those projects, because we're going to have probably multiple projects come across. And so that's one way that they've looked at kind of compensating the departments is if you have an employee that's part of this team, you get priority processing of your projects. So there are some interesting ways to look at it, maybe a little differently.
I have a question, comment. When I think about innovation or reinventing, I think about you've been doing things one way and then you decide, okay, we're going to try things a different way. And that's good. But in this moment, it feels to me like we are being forced to reinvent and innovate because of forces outside our control right now. So I guess my question is this exactly the right moment to be just figuring out how to do something new when we don't even really know what normal looks like quite yet?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Dan. I think there's no shortage of being able to improve the way we operate, whether we're in a crisis moment or not. I mean, I think it's been a constant concern for a lot of departments, particularly ITS. And, you know, Greg was going to be here today. Unfortunately, he was feeling ill, to talk about what some of those demands take on the ITS department when they are asked to be a part of a process improvement, because a lot of it has to do with technology. So a lot of this was trying to support the departments and supporting them and trying to take on initiatives that would improve what they do. I don't think whether we're in a crisis or not, a pandemic or not, that there's going to be a shortage of approaches and trying to improve how we deliver services or how we operate better.
Thank you.
So presumably,
Martha, I have a question, but it's not on this FTE. It's on something, or on this over to OTR. It's on something before.
Okay, let me come back to you then on this one, Jason. So this is basically if we don't. Do we see benefit if we do 1 year but not the second year, or are we really looking at a $250,000 proposal here?
Well, some of it is startup costs. I mean, obviously, we can you evaluate every OTR every year and whether or not you want to continue it or not. And our intent would be to show metrics that would show that there's a benefit from the program. But obviously, if there's no interest to doing it a second year, then we wouldn't do it the second year.
Okay. I mean, I would be very interested in a conversation that includes, maybe this goes to GO, like maybe a better way to do something like this is another person in ITS. I know in the past we've had a smart work, it was called, help from TC3. There was whether it was TC3 Biz or somewhere that you know, came in. So there's more than one flavor of doing this kind of thing. So
I should also add that we took the SmartWorks funding out of the budget with the replacement of this. So when we introduced this, there's about $25,000 of SmartWorks funding that has been taken out of the HR budget.
Okay. Any other questions or thoughts on this?
I think it would be good to get Greg's opinion on it and have him part of the dialogue. And if we want to bring it to GO, I could definitely have Greg and Jay join us in the conversation about the demands that he gets experiences when we talk about new initiatives to improve process. So I think that would be a very good dialogue to have in the next GO meeting.
Okay. Amanda, you're on. Mike Lane.
Jason, if we could, I'd like to go back to your discussion about your full-time equivalents.
Sure.
And the retirement of the contracts officer.
Sure.
I need to understand a little bit more about how that's going to be covered. That's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, wouldn't this be an opportunity to think about contracting out for that service, contracts administration and risk management?
Well, contracts management is the managing of internal contracts, the processing of the contracts, and the approving of the contracts through the system that we have, the internal contract management system. So I don't know that we can contract out that service. The risk management side of things, we do contract out in terms of certain risk management services, whether there's certain services provided by some of our higher insurance carriers. But again, risk management also involves reviewing incident reports, accident reports, and being able to follow up on them. It's dealing with insurance claims. It's in dealing with insurance claims, but also not workers' comp claims, but property damage reports. So it's dealing with, on our end, any of those types of insurance matters. So I think being able to work with our compliance coordinator, who has done a good job on recreating policies and drafting and updating the policies that you've all seen. I think we've done 40 or 50 new ones. Contract management and risk management fits right in the compliance arena. And being able to merge those two responsibilities will be a nice fit. So I don't know where else we would contract out those services, because a lot of them are internal support.
Right.
Is there a specific risk management service that you think would be contracted out?
No, but I know there are contractors out there that do risk management. That was one of the first issues we had when I came on the legislature a long time ago.
Okay.
I see Ann Corman's got her hand up.
Thanks, Martha. So, Jason, just looking at the white papers, I guess, that you sent out last night for the administration, just looking under professional services, the 2020 modified was 86,000, and you're recommending 20,000. So there's a $60,000 difference.
Let me pull it up. Eddie,
where are you?
Let's see. That would be page 4.
Okay, let me pull it up. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. What were you asking again? It was under professional services?
Right. It just, you know, for the last couple of years, we've used 69,000 in 2018 and then 70,000 and then 2020 was 86,000. And then we're looking at the target of 20,000. And it looks like there was a requested OTR for 60,000 that right. You're not recommending. Just wondering what those professional services are for.
So that's a decrease. The primary decrease is the removal of the community outreach worker program. So if that were to be intact, you would be up around 80,000 again, which would be in line with what your prior year's expenses were. So that's why you see that's the primary reason for that change in that budget line, is because that's where the community outreach worker again is a contracted service. So it's a contract. So it would be out of professional services. I'm sorry. So without, if it was in there, you would see the target would be 80,000.
Okay. And then on the next page, 25, under professional services, just wonder what type of thing that use generally is.
Is it on page 25? So that's the WDIC budget. Professional services ranges across a bunch of things. If you look back to 2018, I believe that's where we paid for.
No, it's the next one, public information.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Public information. Public information, professional services. So the reason there's a drop in that is because that's where, and what we would do is by removing the OTRs that I just mentioned about streaming of the legislative meetings, that will be reinstated. There'll be 31,000 back there because that's the contract with CCE for Jim Blue's services to do the production of the legislative meeting. So that will go back and that will be reinstated based on the withdrawal of the OTRs that I just talked about earlier.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, no problem.
All right, thanks everybody. Any other questions for Jason on the admin budget? All right, thank you very much, Jason. So we are way behind, but it is what it is. Finance, Rick Snyder. Hi, Rick. You have some slides for us, I assume.
Good evening. Yes, we do.
Okay.
We have Andrew Brayman here with us tonight and Joanne Carruthers from our accounting division and Lisa Schott from our treasury division.
Hello to everybody.
If they're awake, I can't guarantee that they're still awake. Say hi if you're awake.
Hello.
Okay. Hello. Now, we should be sharing our screen, and Drew gives me thumbs up, so.
Looks good.
Ours is quite short tonight. We generally went to Jason and Kevin in the initiation of this process saying, just keep ours the same. We're just the same. Nothing's changed. We're done. That didn't work out. What we're looking at here on our first slide is, because we have to cut our budget 12% like everyone else, that's what you see in the target column. So between the modified 2020 and the target 2021 column is what we would have had to cut in order to bring it down 12%. What we provided for his consideration, and a lot of the explanation Drew will handle a little bit later, is a lot of OTRs that basically brings us back up to close to our normal funding. We know that we can't really cut positions, and we're not in a position serving 28 departments, about the same number of agencies in the consortium. that we're already pretty strapped as far as labor hours go, and we're not in that position to really reduce staffing. So we put forth a number of OTRs. So what you see in the next column, the 2021 recommended OTRs, is an addition back of almost the full amount of our normal level of funding. So when you see OTRs being recommended to the tune of $144,000, that's within about $13,000 of what our normal funding would have been. The revenues were cut under the understanding that we might, and I say almost positively, that we will still be doing the consortium's books all through next year, but we've cut the funding from the consortium, which means that we're relying more upon local funding to fund all our staff positions. So when you see a revenue being cut there to the tune of $63,789, that was under the understanding that we would stop doing the consortium's books and records and all that's involved as early as January 1st. So we can get more into that OTR a little bit later, but that brought us, for revenues, that brought our revenues down quite a bit, not receiving that $63,000 or $64,000 of consortium funding. I don't think you have the whole budget booklet yet. Is that correct? Or the budget pages?
Yes, that's right. We have your budget. We actually have your departmental budget pages.
Oh, okay. A good place to look comprehensively at our whole budget, it starts on section 4, page 70. And on that first page, it nicely shows our whole department on page. And you can see that the expenditures, even after adding in the OTR, the OTRs that are recommended, our expenditure are down about 0.9%.
All right, Rick, you and I talked earlier about your sound breaking up. Yeah. Okay. Would you try turning off your audio video and let's see if that helps?
Okay.
We know your voice. It's a good question. If that'll take your slides off.
No.
All right, Ted, why don't you keep going? I don't want to take any more time for this.
I've gotten this complaint before, and I'm sorry if the sound quality is not good.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
But page 70 is the summary of our expenditures and revenues. I'm going to turn it over to Drew to go through our full-time equivalents and our actual OTRs. I'll bring up the next slide.
Can I ask a question while you're transitioning?
Sure. Yeah.
Why did you stop getting funds from the consortium if you're still providing services?
We didn't. That revenue was removed. Jason had meetings with Elin, and they had talked about us stopping to do the consortium's work. That was about 2 weeks ago, I think. Since then, we've had at least two meetings with Elin, and she made it clear to us that although they think that they are adding at least one or two finance positions to their roster as a consortium with the intent to eventually take over keeping and all that we do, that's probably going to be phased in over an 18 to 24 month period.
Going to be providing free services. That doesn't make any sense from the county's perspective.
But as a result of our meeting with them last week, they said, no, we don't really want you to stop doing your treasurer duties for the consortium. And I said, well, what do you want us to continue to do? Well, everything that you're doing right now, the quarterly jurat, the monthly journal entries, the receiving of the payments, accounts payable, and accounts receivable. So what they intend on doing is building up a staff of one or two people in the next 18 to 24 months for them to be able to do more financial analysis and their own budgeting, but we would still keep having to do what we're doing right now. So
okay, we should pay for that.
The understanding going forward would be nothing would really change in the next year's budget. And so if we month by month expend our efforts to do exactly what we have been doing for the last 8 or 9 years, that we would continue to bill them at the same rate that we've always billed them. So we would be making that revenue anyway. What OPR did was it stripped it out of the budget, so anything that we would make over and above that would be, basically it would be gravy. It would be more money than what we have allocated in our budget.
We're going to have to really dig into this. This what's on page 77, it says we're replacing target funding because our staff is going to now work on our stuff and not a consortium stuff. So I don't, you know, if it takes them 18 months to hire staff, then they'll pay us until they have the staff.
Should they?
Right. But since this was written and put into the budget, we've had meetings that said that was not their intent to strip us out from not doing their books and records next year.
All right, Jason's got his hand up. Jason?
Yeah, I think there's several things. The intent is that, like Rick said, that they want to take that service over. I think the question is, how long will it take them to do that transition? And that's what these initial conversations were about. If you, for example, take that revenue out, we've accounted for the fact that the revenue will decrease over the course of the next 12 or 18 months or 24 months. So whether we take it out now or whether you have half of it back in or partially it back in, I think over the course of the next 12 to 24 months, it's going to be removed somewhere or another. I mean, they're going to be paying you less as they start to take more on. I will say this. If it takes them longer to get started up, and for the majority of this next year, we continue to provide the service, they're going to continue to pay us for that service. It becomes a budgeting question of, all right, do we want to scale it back a little bit now, scale it all back now, or do we want to piece it out over a two-year period of time? So if you want, you know, not knowing exactly how that's going to pan out, we removed it. And obviously, if we continue to receive the revenue because we're doing the work, which we would, you're never going to not be reimbursed for the work. The question is how long is it going to take for that transition to take? And that has yet to be determined, but we put this our OTR together in anticipation of us losing all that revenue, but it may take 6 months to develop. It may take 10 months to develop. If it takes 12 or 14, then we'll continue to be paid for as long as we're continuing to do that work. What's going on with the consortium is they are growing and expanding. So as you know, this past year they hired an executive director, they have another administrative staff, and they're starting to transition into their own entity. And taking on this role and responsibility themselves is the natural transition they want to go to. There is, though, a hang-up with that, not a hang-up, but there's a process to go through with that. And Rick still provides some level of oversight to that, to, like you said, some of those larger financial pictures, which will probably be the last if anything that shifts over to them. So this was an attempt to capture the lost revenue that we may experience. It may not happen all this next year. It may take a little bit more than that, more than a year to happen, but removing it now allows that flexibility that if you continue to receive the revenue, great. If you don't, it's not a revenue shortfall in the next year's budget. So it's a worst case scenario projection. Does about summarize it right, Rick?
Yeah, and like I said, with our contract with the consortium, and we do have a contract with them that comes up every year at the beginning of the year, we'll just add in the contract. It'll be the same rate, the normal rate that we would have charged in any other year, but there will be a 30 or 60 day termination clause that says, you know, we can stop doing it at that certain point in time.
Okay. I'm not sure why this is a change in the budget, but let's, when we get to the voting, maybe by then we'll have it clear and maybe we can get some like contract language. This is a big question mark. What if, you or Drew go right to the other OTRs?
Sure.
Did you have any other slides on this?
No. Like I said, our full-time equivalents are the same. last year. They were a little bit higher last year. Getting feedback here.
Yeah.
But last year they were at 13.20 because we had dual coverage for a short period of time for the treasury manager. But it's down to 13.
Okay. All right, let me just ask, you have had vacancies over the last few years. Do you have any vacancies right now?
We do. We have Autumn's position, which was the accounts payable clerk. We have a senior clerk position vacancy, and we have a person that's out of the office right now. It's not really a vacancy, but it's a,
on disability or something?
A disability, yeah.
Okay. So you have two.
Go ahead.
Are those intended to be filled, or were these the two that have been zeroed out?
No, they're all being filled right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Drew, you want to go to the OTRs?
Okay, Drew. All yours.
Okay, so on the OTR page, you'll see that we have the first OTR is really the $115,000. And this primarily keeps our positions intact and our services that we provide to, as Rick mentioned, all the departments. It also keeps intact the services we provide out to many of the municipalities, some of the tax work and things that we do for them will continue to keep. Otherwise, we'd have to push that down to the municipalities and maybe some of the things to the other one. Of that OTR, I'll give you just a couple high-level items. Oh, about 35-40% of that is staffing. Another big chunk is professional services, and that's mainly related to the audit work. So what we have is we have a base audit contract that we do every year. Rick will be bringing to you something before the end of the year to continue those services. Almost every year we have additional work that's needed, either that the auditors identify, or a few years ago you may recall the airport, the FAA required some updates on the PFC audits. So in Cerro, the auditors had to go back many years, recreate additional expenses. This would enable us to continue those without having to come back to the legislature each time. I think the other big chunks in there are some training and opportunities like that that we really don't want to cut, especially with the number of new staff that we have here. I'll quickly run through the other two OTRs. We talked about the health insurance, and I think Jason really hit that highlight very well, that this is, if they can get up and running, I mean, it's September now, conceivably if they had a great candidate, they could be up and running in 4 to 6 months, which would put them in the February, March timeframe that we might start experiencing decreased revenues. And the last one is a buyer successor planning. We've had a long-term leave in that position since October of last year, and the person on leave's indicated a desire to retire in 2021. So this would enable us to double up and get someone in and trained in that position in the meantime. So that's our OTRs on a high level.
Thank you, Drew. I see Deborah's hand again.
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep banging on the same drum, but I don't understand why the OTR for $63,000 for relinquishing the consortium services is target if you're just phasing that service out and phasing those revenues out. Then I don't understand why adding the money back into your budget as target makes any sense. At best, it would seem to me it should be in contingent, and it's released to you as needed when the consortium
stops paying for the services you provide.
I think that might be a Jason question.
Sure. So I think there's several things to think about with this. One is, as we relinquish responsibilities for services that we're providing to the consortium. So right now, about 70% of an employee is doing predominantly consortium work, and they pay us for that service. If we no longer provide that service, they no longer pay us. So essentially, Rick's target budget has to decrease by another, expenditures have to decrease by another $63,000 to make up for that loss in revenue. And unless we were going to cut that position, it would create an unbalanced budget. So that's why this is basically allowing him a greater target budget, because he'll be losing the revenue.
But if he's not going to be doing the work, then we don't necessarily need the employee.
Well, if you look at the next slide, there was, you know, there is a need for support in the finance office to support the buyer and payroll services. You have one person that does both of them, or one person each in each of them. In an organization this size, having redundancy provides you with a good a mechanism and an important element of supporting the organization. The vacancy, or the person, this person being able to come back to the office, giving, you know, gaining another 70% of their work, will allow Rick to be able to support both of those functions in a better way than it's being supported now. Did I capture that right, Rick? I don't want to.
Yeah. And simply put, we didn't want to lose 10% of Drew and 10% of the payroll specialists if and when the consortium work went away. We still had a dire need to keep those positions intact. And so this was Jason's way of letting us know that he would support by putting in local dollar funding to take the place of consortium funding if we would stop doing the consortium work next year sometime. And I think that was part of the, it, you know, we kind of backed into that revenue reduction because we were trying to think outside the box and still retain the full services of both of those employees and myself. You know, there's really three or four of us that do work on the consortium. Lisa Christian, Jessica okay. Hobart, Drew Brayman, myself.
I think we understand that. I think the issue is the picking a dollar number when we don't know when this is going to begin, and we don't know. I think what Deborah said earlier, why would we keep doing the work and not get paid?
So that's not what's being proposed.
No. Well,
you always do the work, you'll get paid. Let me put it to you this way. Let's say, for example, the consortium was going to have a hard turnover date of July 1st. That number would be half of 63,000. So it would be 31 and a half now. And then next year you would see another 31 and a half to increase target because you would lose the other half of that revenue. Does that make right. sense? So that's another way of going about doing it, if that's what were to happen. So,
okay. So in a sense, it's like you really want to say up to $63,000 on this line. But we don't have an up to on our budget lines.
It's not knowing the exact turnover date. So obviously, if they continue to do service in next year, they're going to continue to get paid. This okay. still accounts for that loss in revenue in its entirety, which will ultimately happen, whether it's now or whether it's in a year or a year and a half.
That'd be okay? More?
No, I'm done.
Okay.
Here's our last slide, Drew.
Well, and I think that's what we just referred to as the OTR that is not being recommended was adding a position here, which we direly do need to do purchasing for a $180-200 million operation and to do payroll for 700-800 employees. Each of those, as Jason said, with one person has been quite incredible, to put it mildly, and congrats to the folks who have been doing it. With the vacancy and purchasing this year, we've had feedback from many departments that, you know, we need some more support and we want to get that to them. So.
Okay. So you have these as priority one and two. Usually that means that's what the, you know, that's the first priority for new money. The second.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes.
That remains the department's priority. But you put them in the other order because you were showing us what Jason has included in his budget.
Correct. that and priority four in a way replaces this not recommended OTR.
Okay.
By taking the duties out for the consortium, we can reallocate that staff time.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Okay.
So our goal would be to do that sooner than later.
Got it. So we want to make sure they find somebody or a couple people that they need, right?
Right.
Okay. Does anybody, I'm good. Deborah, you're good. Anybody else have any other questions? All right. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate this and look forward to hope we can make this all work. Thank you. Human Resources. We have Lisa Holmes here.
There.
Hi, Lisa.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good.
Go.
you are. Let me start my screen sharing. Okay. Is that working for everybody? And is it in presentation mode?
It's not in presentation mode.
All right. Let me. Here we go.
Thank you.
Okay. So, this will hopefully be pretty brief. So just looking at our recommended budget, in 2020, our adopted budget was for human resources was about 1.2 million. Recommended budget for 2021 is about 1.1 million. And this includes a $30,000 over target request, resulting in a net reduction of approximately 105,000 or about 8.6%. And I'll just provide you with a spoiler alert right now and say we've achieved this reduction primarily by reducing organizational training funds for 2021. And I'll get more into the reasoning and strategy behind that when we talk about the OTRs, but just suffice it to say I'm not recommending reductions in staffing to meet the budget target. Our full-time equivalents in the HR department, number 9, that was the same FTE count as last year, and I'm recommending the same staffing level in 2021. And then getting right to the OTRs for this budget, and again, which has to do with a reduction in the training budget. And there's pretty good historical basis for this, as well as an acknowledgement of our present day situation with COVID-19 and kind of what we expect to see with COVID in 2021. So we've had a solid budget for organization-wide training, and it's something I don't think we should sacrifice in the long term. But for the past 3 years, the organization-wide training funds have been underutilized, not fully optimized. In 2018, we had a training budget of about $160,000, and we utilized only about $85,000. In 2019, we did a little better. We utilized about $123,000 out of $160,000 total. And in 2020 to date, we just looked today and we've utilized approximately $40,000. And again, this is primarily due to the reduction is primarily due this year to the wide scale cancellation of conferences, travel, and in-person training opportunities because of COVID. In addition to that, and Jason mentioned it before in, for the last 3 years, HR has also had $27,000 in a separate line item under professional services for the Smart Work initiative that has been virtually unutilized, and that has not been utilized at all in the 2020 budget. So, you know, we can conclude a few things from this. I think this is the best place to incur a reduction from the HR budget for 2021 without causing harm to the organization or affecting staffing, which is greatly needed in HR. I don't think that in-person training or travel to large conferences is going to be happening anytime too soon in 2021, unfortunately. So by taking that reduction in the training line, as proposed, would leave us with about 41,000 for 2021. The over target request for 30,000 will give us a total of 71,000 in our training for 2021. And this would hopefully be a realistic amount to serve our needs for next year. But moving forward, we would seek to rebuild and replenish the training budget probably over the next 3 years to bring it back somewhere around its previous total. And at the same time, develop a strategic training program to assure that we're utilizing those funds fully throughout the organization. So that's all I've got.
Questions from folks. Amanda Champion.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. Mm-hmm. I think I have two questions. I think I understood your explanation about the training. Is this the training fund for every department? Do departments have any separate training funds?
Some departments have their own training funds. The one that comes to mind is DSS. They have their own training funds, and they have a lot of specific kind of state-mandated training. However, they sometimes and many other departments utilize training funds out of the HR office if they don't have a large training budget or if there's, you know, one significant training that they might need help subsidizing. So.
Okay. And then, thank you. And then one other question on the page 97, the breakdown. So the salary and wages is going down, but the fringe is going up. And I just wondered what that meant.
Is it because the fringe rate went up by that amount? I think that has to do with the increase in the fringe rate would be my first guess looking at it.
Would that be the pension increase, or is that not broken out by department?
Jason, it's not broken out by department.
It could be yeah, that's what it looks like, that it could be related to fringe. The fringe rate went up as a result, so that could be the case. We can look at it a little closer.
But it's a small drop in salary.
Yeah.
Were there extra people? I mean.
Is this on page 97?
Yeah, was there a one-time person?
Yeah.
The small drop in salary is we changed some titles around in HR. There were different, and there were some vacant titles, and they were pegged at different salaries. So this is an accurate accounting of the salaries and positions in HR to date.
That actual is actual. If you had vacancies, that means the fringes wouldn't have been charged against the account. So I think you had one or two vacancies in that year. So that would make sense on why the actual is lower. The modified budget essentially is what the 2020 adopted is. And that is similar to the target for 21. So that appears to be correct. The differential, Amanda, is probably the fact that in such a small department like this, if you have a vacancy for a year or two, or for a year, if you have one vacancy for a year and another for a half, that could be up to 30,000-40,000 because a health care plan is, you know, fringes are about 50% of the salary. So that's probably, we can double check, but that's probably the case.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Martha?
Yeah?
I had a question. Maybe I should have asked it of Jason during his administration presentation, but I guess I was kind of surprised to see the chief equity and diversity officer in his budget as opposed to in the human resources department. I wondered what the thinking was there.
Sure, I can answer that. Mike. When the recommendation was made last year, it was recommended that it be in the county administrator's office so that it carries the county administrator, the county administration's purview and oversight over the whole organization. When they did their research, they found that a lot of other places that had equity and diversity officers found greater success, and that the organization, took it more seriously, and it respected the position greater because it had the office of either the city manager or the county executive or the county administrator's office. So rather than it being an HR function, it carries the weight with the whole organization and the chief executive of the organization. So that was part of the recommendation that the diversity, infusion, and inclusion team had recommended that it come out of our office.
So is it basically like a third deputy?
No, I think, Deanna is really working on equity issues across the organization. So it's another function focusing on equity and diversity issues. A lot of the work that we're doing, we're going to be incorporating that position in and helping, and looking at things from an equity lens, but it doesn't act in the same sense. I mean, deputies can range in a variety of areas. This is going to be a lot more focused in terms of its function.
All right, thanks.
I'd like to say something.
Yes, go ahead, Dan.
Thank you. I want to thank Lisa and Jason for the work that they did to find positions for all the people that were about to lose their jobs. I have to admit that I was thinking about things very wrongly, differently, really coming at it from a different way. And when I heard, I didn't expect this at all. And it's just such good news. I was just so delighted when I saw this in the budget statement. I recognize that for some of the employees, it's not ideal, but it is so much better, I would think, to have a choice rather than just being told you're being laid off. It seems kind of miraculous to me that the two of you or whoever else was involved was able to pull this off. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you for that acknowledgement, Dan. And I also want to acknowledge Laura Granger and Heather Buck, who are on the Zoom tonight. They did a lot of work on this, finding the positions. They also helped with this year's budget proposal. So a lot of thanks goes to them.
Absolutely. Well said, Dan. Thank you. Fantastic. It really is kind of a miracle. It's great. Any other questions or comments? I do have one. Anybody else? Leslin.
Thank you, Martha. So Dan's comment made me think of the innovation work that Jason has in his over-target budget. And I just wanted to emphasize that the work and ideas for cost savings, for maintaining staff, for increasing staff capacity, for allowing staff to spread their wings is what something like that position does. And it's almost the exact reason that Dan, you're talking about how people think is what we pay these folks to do. And I really appreciate the thinking around that particular position, and especially something that's generated by our department heads, because we're going into even more uncertain times and people are thinking thoroughly about how not only can we save costs, but how we can increase efficiencies and keep people engaged within our employment. So I want to thank you all for that, and for all of us to keep an open mind in just understanding it's things like exactly what you're talking about that makes these folks tick and make things work so well within our organization. So thank you.
Thanks, Leslin. Anybody else? My question, Lisa, is the big drop in training expenditures this year. You said we had budgeted $169,000 and only used $40,000 so far, if I get that right. are people going to training like this, but not traveling and staying in a hotel and eating meals? I mean, every time we go to NYSAC, it's a lot of money because we're going somewhere, but a lot of us are participating this week and next in webinars at NYSAC, and it won't cost anything. So is the training still happening? It's just that people aren't traveling.
I would say it's both, yes. So everything's moved online, and people are participating in a lot of, training. There are some staff or state mandated training that has moved to online, or in one case I know of a regional training. But yes, there have been several cancellations of planned conferences, planned travel. So yes, both.
Okay, so it'll be interesting to sort of build that back up, but maybe it won't have to be quite as expensive if the future includes more remote training. So,
agreed.
Leslie, did I see your hand again?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Right on the training, we might very well be mistaken that it's not going to be as expensive as training outfits are getting online and realizing they have to invest more money in technology, these trainings are getting much more expensive. So I want to caution around thinking in that line. I'm experiencing this in my own agency and trying to get people to trainings and how much more expensive some of them already are. So that's going to happen. And then quickly, I just wanted to respond a little bit to Mike's question about the Chief Equity and Diversity. When we started the work of diversity and inclusion within the county, we made a deliberate decision with county administration at that time and the legislature that work will reside in administration and not in HR, because it's sort of, for both of them, a little bit of checks and balances as well, and they play well off of each other. But it was a very deliberate and intentional decision to have that any work with diversity and inclusion reside and come out of county administration.
Thank you, Leslie. Anybody else have questions? I realized I have one more. Do you have any vacancies, Lisa? And I think the recruiter is probably one. What do you have, and what might or might not, how's that going to be on what's filled?
So, as you know, we have a big one, which is commissioner. We also have recruiter, and we have a labor relations specialist, which is another title that, and originally the thought was, before COVID, the commissioner was going to be pretty close in line to being filled, and then that person would have a say in bringing on the new staff. Our plans got changed. So, I'm very much wanting to get those other two searches online as well.
Okay, so you have the okay to go ahead and fill both of those?
Yes.
All right. Any other questions, comments? All right, if you want to unshare your screen, thank you. Well, it's 7:30. Jason, you had asked if we wanted to, we thought we might have ended an hour earlier than this. Did we want to have a brief executive session? I guess I would ask, for starters, are you interested in doing that? And to my colleagues, should we take 15 minutes now, if people feel ready to do that? Most of you have your little black boxes, so I can't tell. I got 2 thumbs up, 3 thumbs up, 4. Okay. All right. Jason, you okay with that?
Yes, that works fine for me.
Well, you're asking us to hold over for now for an executive session?
That's right. We had started that. We had started, I think Jason said that at the beginning, that we might, rather than have it at the end of the legislature meeting tomorrow night, that we would try to, we thought tonight was going to be relatively short. We would do it now. Let's try to keep it maybe brief and just get an information download and, discussion to continue, if that's okay. All right. Can I have I'm going to ask them for a motion to go into executive session or to discuss real estate issues. Deborah moves. Amanda seconds.
Is it just real estate?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't understand that. All right.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go across the screen. I see Henry. Is a motion, is a yes from Henry. Mike Lane.
Yes.
Dan Klein.
Yes.
Deborah.
Yes.
Dave.
Yes.
Shauna. I can't hear Shauna. All right. I'm going to go to Glenn.
Yes.
Annie Corman.
Yes.
Leslin.
Yes.
Amanda.
Yes.
Anna. Mike Sigler.
Yes.
Shauna. I still can't hear Shauna, but.
She messaged yes.
All right. All right, I think we got everybody, and I'm a yes, so we're going to go into executive session. I do not expect we'll take any action after this. And let's take a five-minute break so that we can switch over the camera and the things Kathy has to do. All right, thank you very much, folks.